It's time for Mac Break Weekly. Alex is back. Andy Iannacco's here. Jason Snell as well. We'll talk about the new encrypted group chat that John Gruber's been flogging. Apple Music Classicals finally here, along with iOS 16.4. Ventura has an update as well. And Apple deciding it wants to get into the movie business. It's all coming up next on Mac Break Weekly.
Podcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
This is Mac Break Weekly, episode 863, recorded Tuesday, March 28th, 2023. Who will speak for the shrubbery? This episode of Mac Break Weekly brought to you by Club Twit. Thank you, Club Twit members, for your contributions. Thanks for listening to this show as an ad-supported network. We are always looking for new partners with products and services that will benefit our qualified audience. Are you ready to grow your business? Reach out to advertise at twit.tv and launch your campaign now. It's time for Mac Break Weekly, the show where we cover the latest Apple news. Alex Lindsay's back from his sojourn abroad. Did you go abroad?
No, I just had productions. We had a...
Did you leave the house?
I did leave the house.
Oh, okay.
2 weeks ago, we had a theater event that I do. And last week, we covered the generative AI meetup in San Francisco.
Good time for that. Hours. That must have been interesting. Wow.
It was really cool. I mean, it was like all the thinkers.
How much of
thinking
office,
about this right now?
Yeah. How much of office hours now is about AI?
It's a growing amount. I mean, a lot of people, the questions come up. Two or three questions a day related to it, and I use it. I had a presentation this morning about green screen. I made most of the images from Midjourney, so it kind of just see
it's,
that
it's all in there, baby.
I said, "Give me a Muppet in front of a green screen shot with a Sony A7 S3, short up the field." And we were talking about but I have all of these Muppets as examples, and they're
that's
different
really
Muppets because Midjourney keeps on putting them up differently. Yeah. So it's.
And Muppets don't have hands, so that's not a problem. Actually, I love Midjourney. We've been playing with Midjourney V5, and it's really, wow. Oh. Anyway, we'll get to that. Officehours.global, if you're wondering what Office Hours is, it's Alex's, he's got a day job at 090.media. I guess it's his midday job.
It's my morning.
This is his Tuesday job. So. Okay. Welcome.
Yeah, exactly.
Welcome back.
Yeah.
We missed you. Also here, Mr. Andy Iannacco from WJBH in Boston. Hello, Andrew.
Hey ho!
You look good.
Thank you. I brushed my sideburns today.
You're in fine fettle.
Thank you for noticing.
Yeah, or South fine fettle, I guess.
The extra couple hours of daylight are really, really.
I
really
agree.
Well,
loving it. I looked out the window at 7 p.m. and went, "It's still light." What?
Or in my case, over the weekend, looking out the window at waking up at 4:30 and not knowing whether I just fallen asleep for only 2 hours or whether I'd actually slept for 14 hours. And I lead the sort of lifestyle where it really could have been either one. It's fun.
Did I miss a whole day, a whole week, a whole month? I don't know.
Am I really well rested right now or should I go back to bed?
And from sixcolors.com, the wonderful Jason Snell.
Hello, Leo Laporte. It's good to hear from you.
It's a musical.
And, Micah Sargent has rubbed off on you. Now you're starting to sing everything.
Does he sing? Yeah, maybe that's it. He might be rubbing
Micah
off on
sings
me.
Everything, yeah. Yes, if you let him.
Yeah. I don't know if that's me rubbing off on him or him rubbing off on me at this point.
Oh, interesting.
We're merging.
You're a dangerous combination.
We're merging.
It's like matter and antimatter, yeah.
Jason will be hosting the show next week. I'm going on vacation for 3 weeks, then Micah for a couple of weeks. Hosting, and I'll be back on the 25th, and I hope you have a wonderful time. Have you fallen into the John Gruber hole? Do you know what I'm talking about?
The John Gruber hole? I mean, not lately. It's been a while. I thought the city of Philadelphia patched that hole.
Is that the tourist trap that his family runs? It's just out of Barstow? Like
John
the Gruber mystery hole?
I think probably 2,000 word piece about a new piece of software. It's a group, end-to-end encrypted group messaging app called Wavelength. Long piece on it. About two-thirds of the way in, he said, "Oh, yeah. And by the way, I am
I'm an advisor and have equity.
I have equity. It's like, wait a minute. Hold on there. Was a very extensive and very praiseful piece. So I signed up. I mean, what the hell? Although I'll tell you one thing. I got one. First of all, I think it's a great idea. I don't disagree with him to have a fully encrypted group chat program that's not owned by Facebook. I think that's a good thing. WhatsApp is so dominant in the world. And yeah, it's end-to-end encrypted, I guess, but it's owned by Facebook. So I guess that's their competition. The other thing that they're doing, because this is what everybody does now, is slathering a thin layer of AI over it.
You can, for fun, for funsies.
Just for funsies. And I don't like that. I just want to say, because the AI is in the chat with you. And it's just like, for me, it's like ads in Twitter. You have to use a certain amount of cognitive effort load to say, is this a person or is this an ad or is it a chat or AI or, you know, and I don't want to do that. I don't like to do that. It's not my thing. Andy?
Yeah, it sounds a lot like Google Wave, especially when you put AIs inside the chat. But hey, if they can revive it, I thought Google killed that way before it was dead.
Yeah, okay. I don't know. There's AI everywhere now. Last week, Google's Bard came out, but that's not an Apple story. So we'll save that for this week in Google or some other show. Who cares? I just was wondering because I noticed a lot of us Gruber fans ended up in Wavelength.
Oh, I noticed you were on there before I
beat
signed
you
up.
To it.
I was like, Leo's already there. Oh, yeah. Leo already read it. And this morning I had a list of friends, all of whom had signed up while I was sleeping. I'm like, okay, all right. Yeah. We all read it.
Yeah, we all read it. It's fine. It's cool. The problem with all of these is not that whether it's functionality or, I mean, it's beautiful and it's functional and it's end-to-end encrypted. It's Apple only, which is a big problem so far. And, of course, adoption. If your friends aren't on it, it doesn't matter. If they're all on WhatsApp, which they are, in everywhere but U.S., then it mocks Nix. Anyway, let's move on. I'm sure you will be talking more about that or not as the weeks fly by.
Oh, the confidence of somebody who's about to go on vacation.
I can't wait. I am just, I
That's
am
gonna be
so
great,
out
great
of
topic,
here.
Great topic. Good luck with it, guys.
Good luck
great
with topic. It. Have fun. I am so out of here.
Knock yourselves out.
16.4 came out yesterday for iOS. And iPad OS. And oh my goodness, it's all about the emojis. Lots of new emojis.
A handful.
Yeah.
This year's emoji crop was a little light, right?
21. 21. We've talked about them before, shaking head, pink heart, blue heart, gray heart, donkey, moose.
Goose.
Not a donkey, moose, goose, but three different things, donkey, moose, and goose. A blackbird, a wing, a jellyfish, a hyacinth. Actually, the biggest thing for me and Andy is Apple Classical. And I figured that was tied somehow to 16.4. And sure enough, shortly after I updated to 16.4, I got a message saying, oh, hey, Classical's available for download. So they made their March 28th deadline. Have you reviewed it? Have you examined it, Andrew?
I spent last night taking a look at it. I'm not sure if it requires. I haven't looked at the requirements page. All I know is that I did download the app and run it before I installed 16.4 on my device.
Yeah, it may not require it. Yeah.
However, that might be the reason why there were a couple of bugs with it when I ran it before the update. Now it's running perfectly fine. And yeah, I've been listening to it like part of last night and into this morning. It's really nice. I don't see it as a revolution necessarily, but it didn't have to be a revolution. I like the fact that just simply the fact that it understands that, as we've said before, with classical music, there are all of the tags that you have to put into every single one of these things. All the metadata is so incredibly valuable because it overwhelms Apple Music and Spotify and any other conventional player because there are just so many different things that make a classical track searchable. So, and I also like the fact that just, again, the other's a simple thing where I'm used to not being able to know what the hell I'm listening to because the name of the track is like Wolfgang Amadeus Mozart, open parentheses, 1713. So I'll close parentheses, Abduction from the Seraglio, opus, blah, 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 directed by blah, blah, blah. And I'm still waiting for what is the name of the aria I'm listening to right now. And it's very, very sensibly, like, we'll just simply say, here is the name of the piece you're listening to right now. And then everything else comes in underneath it. But very good. Also, it seems like it has a nice number of curated playlists and curated options. I don't know if I'm surprised or not surprised that so many of them are introduction to classical music. Here is your first introduction to this. So if it helps a lot of people discover a variety of music that maybe they hadn't paid much attention to, that's great. It's going to make classical music lovers less upset than they were before. It's not going to be possible to make them all really, really happy, but they promised it. They, as you and I have been saying, they bought a service that we liked. That service has disappeared for 2 years while it's been rebranded. So let's just hope that Apple continues to put effort and updating and new thoughts and new content into this, and not just simply, you know, decide 2 years later that, oh, I guess that was just a hobby after all.
I guess inevitably it's going to, the comparison is going to be to PrimePhonic, the app that they bought, the company that they bought a year and a half ago. You can show it now. And there you go. Thank you. And took their time getting out. Introducing Apple Music Classical with Alex French. I don't know why there's two F's in French. Is just a 2 minute track. A couple of things I really liked. There's a lot, it looks very much like PrimePhonic, even down to, I was very pleased. I really like the PrimePhonic podcast. They have the story of classical, which is both music and text, kind of explaining. It's a 9-part companion guide to classical music, which I think is. I'll be listening to that on the plane. I'm sure. They also have a whole spatial audio section. Of course, it's Apple, right?
Yeah.
And that actually put me over the top, bringing my AirPod Pro Max on the plane, because I do want to listen to these, if you're in the concert hall. Would be pretty fun. I presume I didn't attempt to figure out if they have everything, but I'm happy. I think this is what we wanted, right?
I gave it a few curveballs. The fact of the matter is that almost anything that I could think of is actually probably already covered by Apple Music. It's only these really, really random moments where you're reading a blog post about here are the 10 best versions of Mahler's sixth symphony, and you're like, oh, I'd actually like to listen to some of these, and only like two of them are in Spotify or Apple Music, and in Apple Classical you'll see like four or five. But it's a really, really deep catalog. That's how a lot of people get, especially with opera. It's not just the composer, right. It's not just the conductor. It's like, I want to hear Roberto Tibaldi sing this aria, then I want to hear Diana Damrau sing this, then I want to hear, you want to compare, you want to see, you want to figure out what the best version is, even if it isn't in stereo yet.
Yeah. See all the Maria Callas albums, and you get quite a few classic performances from the 50s through the 70s. So yeah, I think this is satisfying.
I haven't tried it on my iPad. There was some grousing online about
it. It's not an iPad app. iPhone only app, which really is disappointing. Yeah.
You could run it on the iPad with the majesty of the big black bars on the side of it.
That's very disappointing.
Unless you put it in Stage Manager, it's just not there.
This would be so nice.
And it doesn't run on the Mac at all, because to run on a Mac, an iOS app has to have an iPad view, which it doesn't. So it's only iPhone, and then, in the big compatibility window on the iPad.
I have to think that's something they will do, although you'd think with a year and a half. They would have, and they could have just taken the PrimePhonic code base, but obviously they did not want to do that, and so they didn't.
I kind of wonder whether we'll see an iPad version before we see an Android version. Like, are they really interested in growing Apple Music and Apple Classical beyond this one platform, or are they seeing this as a bonus for loyal subscribers to Apple Music?
Yeah,
who knows?
I'm pleased. I think if you're a classical music fan, you'll be satisfied. And if you're new to classical, which is, I think, fairly important, this is a great resource to kind of get you started, I think. So, a lot of good categorization going on here, and
and things like that.
And let's not forget, this isn't a separate service. It is part of Apple Music. So if you subscribe to Apple Music, you also get Apple Classical. So it's a win-win.
Yeah, I'm very happy. So, okay, we'll give a tentative A, not a plus, but a tentative A to Apple, and pending an Android version and a iPad version, which you'd think. So you can't do Catalyst unless you have those different screen sizes. That makes sense, I guess. Mm. So then we could get it on our Mac if they ever do that as well. Anything else to say about 16.4?
I think the most interesting thing about it, if you still make phone calls, which I don't know if you do, I don't know who does, but they had this tech that they built into like FaceTime and other things, which was noise canceling.
Yeah.
And they're bringing that to regular phone calls. So it's going to try to do a much more active job of processing your voice and dropping the background noise out when you're making a regular old phone call on your iPhone, which might be good.
They call it voice isolation. And I always turn it on. I don't know, on FaceTime. I don't know if it does any good, but I always turn it on. And you know what? Again, I'd probably be trying this as I call people from airports and the Sagrada Familia and that kind of thing. I'll be making lots of phone calls from all over Europe. Duplicates album and photos expand support to detect duplicate photos in an iCloud shared photo library. That's actually where you really need it, because I'm sharing my photos of you, Jason Snell, with you. Many may be duplicates. So I think it's good that they're doing that. You still, I presume, have to do a manual merge, but at least you could find them. Andy, I'm sorry.
Oh, no. I was going to mention that I was looking at the Apple security update at the Apple support page for about the security content of 16.4 and seeing, boy, it's a long, long list of things that they fix, including a lot of the phrase able to execute arbitrary code with kernel privileges.
Ow.
Pops up a few times. An app may be able to break out of its sandbox, gain access to protected parts of the file system. So yeah, this is a lot of hopefully a lot of things that have not been exploited just yet to merit a tap on the shoulder from Project Zero.
Yeah. Hey, the good news is they're constantly patching things, right?
Of course.
The bad news is there's some of these are pretty severe. Yeah,
again,
zero click in the wild, 0 days is not good.
Arbitrary code with kernel privileges. That's bad.
There is voiceover support for maps in the weather app. Okay, it's a couple accessibility features.
Are people using the weather app? I moved completely to Carrot.
I'm gonna.
Like, once they killed Dark Sky.
Yeah.
Regular people are.
I bet you 90% of iPhone users don't even. You got weather. What do you need?
Carrot's a lot better.
How much weather do you need?
Yeah.
Right?
But if you're listening, Carrot's a lot better. When I had Dark Sky, I was so embedded in Dark Sky that I didn't really think about it. And so I bought Carrot or whatever, downloaded Carrot a long time ago. And it's especially with all the weather, the rain, and everything else right now. It's particularly funny if you turn the attitude all the way up.
There's
not
a great
safe for work, but
I know Garrett is so snarky.
Yeah,
I just like the notifications because every time it drizzles here, which lately has been often, it will say horrible profane. I turned it all away, of course. Horrible profane things. You can also choose your political party. You know, like, are you left, right, progressive, communist? There's communist is my choice. And so you can get a little political thought in there, too, which is a lot of fun. Mm. Here is a very nice piece by Srini Kadamati from nightingaledvs.com, which I've never heard of, but it's a data visualization site. A eulogy for Dark Sky, a data visualization masterpiece. And in this, Srini compares, weather and Dark Sky. Oh, this is sad. The dead Dark Sky interface. It's 0 degrees everywhere. But I agree, Dark Sky was kind of brilliant. We've talked before about the difference between Dark Sky and the kinds of forecasts you get from the National Weather Bureau.
And other little things like easily being able to change the city something that Dark Sky and Carrot have in common. That I still, every time I open up Weather, I'm like, what?
It's there. We talked about that. It's there. You can find it, but you're right. It's not as easy.
It just, it's surprising that Apple would miss that.
Yeah.
No, but then I went over to Carrot and immediately found it. It's just like where the city name is. It'd be really good if I just tap on it and change a new name. I know that sounds crazy, but I will say that I've become a little bit of a curmudgeon about Apple's aggressiveness related to interface recently. And like Ventura has been just a disaster in my opinion. I just hate it. I hate that.
Settings drives me nuts still. Every time I open
the
it.
Settings drive me. Like when I'm talking about screensaver, I would like all the settings for screensaver to be in the same place. Not like my lock screen is now somewhere else. And I can't, this morning I was looking at an update and I'm like, it wasn't straight, you know, it's just all these things, nothing about it is natural and nothing is connected. Like you're in a certain zone. I don't care if you copy it to another place, but when I'm talking about this thing, I should be able to do all the things with that thing in one place. And I think that I just hope that, I mean, there's rumors that the next operating systems are all going to be clean up, and I hope Apple just doesn't change anything. Like I'm just like, just add a couple things and call it a day.
I mean,
like,
they need to change the settings app is what they need to do.
They need to go back.
Don't just leave that the same. Fix that fast. I don't know how many... Yeah. I wrote thousands of words about how all the ways that settings app is bad last summer. And, you know, they didn't change anything.
When it was in beta, they could have.
Good luck. Search for it.
Yeah. They were listening and then ignoring.
I waited. You know, like it was one of the things I waited. The reason I'm complaining about now, and you're wondering why didn't he complain about it earlier, is because after the last update, I was like, I'm going to wait 6 months. And so I waited 6 months. And so only a couple of weeks ago have I installed Ventura. And now I wish I hadn't. So I'm now going to, my new thing will be is the next operating system, unless there's something really good, I'm just going to wait until the following WWDC and let them sort this stuff out and hopefully it gets better. But I think they're missing the mark. I think that they're, and it's not like, there's some stability issues. I think they're moving too fast for their developers. So there's a lot of stability issues across a lot of different apps, and it's just because Apple's changing so many things so quickly to try to get this to sync things up with the iPad. And I think that there's all these things that are happening all at one time, and it's just really, nothing is quite as, I just think that Apple needs a rest. That's all.
Yeah.
The seventh day.
A nap? You know, like just take a nap would be good.
Take a nap for a year would be great. Just fix the things that need to be fixed. And, you know, like, and just, you know, just
happy or you're cranky and tired, you need to go to bed now.
Yeah, exactly. Uh-huh. Exactly. Okay.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I still find myself having to use Spotlight. I will open up settings, but I'll still have to use Spotlight to find the thing that I'm actually looking for. And I didn't have to do that before. Although Apple sometimes does change its mind. One of the breakthrough features of 16.4 is that in iBook in the Books app now you get back that super
turning
curly page
pages.
Animation anymore.
Love you, the
it's
turning
no longer
pages.
As boring as a Kindle.
So the kids can remember.
People complain about page turning. Guess what? They said, you know what? We can give you back your page turning. Congratulations. You're welcome.
It's a historical lesson for the kids.
Let me just show you. Let's see. I see what books I have on my.
Of the 800 things you complain about, we decided that this is the least amount of trouble.
Here's a quarter, kid.
Let's open Common Lisp recipes because I know you're all can't wait. Oh, you know, you probably want to do doing math with Python. There's a better book, but let me just install one of these here real quick because I guess I don't have any books on my. I don't read books on the iPhone. Oh, wait a minute. Here's one. Oh, no. It's in the cloud, too. Darn it. They're all up there in the puffiness. I want to show you the page turning. So that raises the question. Why did they change it? And did they bring it back because we complained? Is that what happened?
I think that kind of thing feels like an executive said. There's an executive somewhere at Apple that was using that really liked the page turn and something happened because I think it's
the opposite. I think that there was some executive at Apple who was like, oh, that page turn is dumb. Take it out. And everybody was like, no, people love it. And they're like, no, take it out. And then everybody complained about it. And they're like, all right, okay, I guess you were right.
You think it was Johnny? Was one of those, though, it was like an anti-Johnny Ive.
How long has it been out?
Skeuomorphism. Kick it out there. Yeah. It was only just in October or September when they shipped it that they pulled it out. So it's a recent removal, which is like, why now? Why now would you do that thing? And so then they put it back. I like it. I really like it when Apple tries to do something and they think that like no one will notice and nobody cares. And then everybody screams bloody murder and they're like, okay, fine. It's like when Steve Jobs was like, you can have a bumper case. It's that kind of exasperation, right. But right. At least it's back. And the truth is, we think of Apple as monolithic, but I always imagine that what's happening is there's a big argument inside Apple and they lose it. And then the media complains about it and users complain about it. And the people inside Apple go, see? And then maybe they get it reversed in the long run. I keep thinking that's what happened here.
Apparently, you have to turn it on because I'm getting...
Yeah,
the old slide. This is the bad page turn.
Right. So as a classic book would do, where you would put your finger on a piece of paper and slide it away out of the book.
So how do I? I saw a little pop up, and I of course was in too much of a hurry.
You know, it's funny.
Go to the themes and settings section.
It's funny how important those transitions are too, because one of the problems we have I do a lot of work with captions, and one of the things with captions that happens is that a lot of the social networks will just have them just jump, you know, just change. But if you watch it on TV, it rolls. It kind of rolls from one, and it's much more pleasurable to watch the captions roll than to watch them jump, because it's easier to read them. And it was funny because I was talking to somebody who really specializes in this, and he's like, you know, the government spent a lot of money figuring out the way that those captions, it was a lot easier just to have them keep on appearing and not having them roll. Everyone should stop reinventing the wheel.
So you go to so I finally figured this out. You click this button in the lower right. You go to themes and settings, and there's a little thing that you can have slide, curl, or none. Now, maybe none is what the guy with the captions would want, but let's turn a little curling on. Wait a minute. Oh, look at that.
Didn't work.
None is. I think I'm team none, but I love that the whimsy of the curl is back.
That was one of the things I loved about the Books app to begin with. That was like the fact that somebody wanted to show off the graphics primitives, the things that you can get for free.
You think it's so expensive in terms of code that's why they got rid of it, or
I don't know that they if they got rid of it, it might have been I wonder if it was an accessibility thing where as part of the debate internally, it was that this doesn't give all users the exact same experience, and therefore we should delete the one that we can't support with an assistive device, or might have been something as simple as they finally got around to like basically rewriting that entire system, and when it came time to we forgot to put in the page curl thing, it's like I am not going to go home at 11 p.m. tonight because we needed to put in a page curl effect.
Yeah.
You get a page flip and I get to go home at 8.
So your recommendation, Jason, is none, where you just tap it and it kind of, it's a quick dissolve is what it is.
I think it's a personal preference. I always felt like those animations were unnecessary, but I know that people love them, and they're not because they're necessary, but because they're fun, and that's fine. But I'm also, I recently reviewed which is kind of outside the purview of this show, but I reviewed an Android-based e-ink reader, so it's like trying to be a Kindle, but it runs full Android.
Yeah.
And one of the problems I had is so many of the book reading apps on Android are like, we'll do fun animations.
Yeah.
And on an e-ink display, the fun animations end up being like an earthquake happens every time you try to change the page. They're really ugly and bad.
Yeah.
So I have a little animosity toward fun animations because of that experience. But in general, it's sort of like, I love that they give people the chance to do it. I love that page curl is totally unnecessary. And I think that there is a school of thought that is probably, I probably support it, that Apple, because it's so successful and it reaches so many people, especially with the iPhone, that they've decided to kind of stamp out any whimsy, because it's like, this is serious. We can't be whimsical. We have to serve our billions and billions of hamburgers instead. And the page curl is a great example of that. What does it serve? Nothing. No reason. It doesn't help anything at all. It's completely gratuitous, but you know what it is? It's fun and whimsical. And so why destroy it? Right? Like why kill that feature? So I'm glad it's back. I'm glad
Microsoft. I know nobody here uses Windows, but Microsoft, often when it removes a feature or adds a feature, cites telemetry. They say, well, we know that no one uses that. You know, you may like it, you three people, and you're very loud, but we know no one uses it. Does Apple have that kind of telemetry on its stuff? Do they know, for instance, that nobody has that turned on? Or
they do have some of that. Although, remember, we did that. We covered that story here where you can turn that off or you have to opt in, but it was still sending data back, and
right.
we still
well,
have
Well, you opt in for third year. Party. I know it says you want to send information to developers, but that's not
right.
Apple.
I believe there is also the Apple telemetry that happens.
Oh, okay.
I don't know how much they record, but you've got to think that through some method or other, Apple has some detail. I don't know if it goes down to the level of do people use / like the page curl.
I don't think it's a bad thing to know.
I do think they've got to have a lot of data.
I think it's good to know, like, everybody has that turned off except for, you know, 1/10 of 1% of the users. And so my guess would be that they had that.
Yeah.
And that
if
somebody said, well, why are we putting in this 400 lines of code to do something that 1/10 of 1% does? And then that 1/10 of 1% was loud and obnoxious. And so they said,
it's a real argument stopper if you're inside Apple and you're saying, but I like this, but I don't. You know, you could go have as much anecdata you could possibly
what are the metrics?
Have. But if you're like, nobody uses the feature, we have the proof. Then it's like, all right. I mean, what do you say to that? Okay, we have the proof. I'll take it out.
On the other hand, nobody uses the chess app.
Why is that still there? Yeah. Somebody, that's a really interesting point.
I think the last time that anybody at Apple said anything about that, it was a vague faint towards it's required for the security checksum to check the integrity of the install, i.e. if it's not there, then some piece of internal math goes wonky and it won't certify that this is a legit installation of Mac OS. But that could, I think that was a while ago, and I never understood that explanation to begin with.
Yeah. Well, there you have it. Now, iOS 17 is next. Actually, will there be a 16.5, 16.6? I guess there'll be one more update.
There's a beta already out there. They just started the beta cycle.
Of 16.5.
Of 16.5, okay. And presumably there'll be a macOS, 13.4 beta.
Okay.
This will be the last. This is like the bug fix cleanup that comes up right before WWDC and is just there probably to sweep out the last bugs that they're going to fix or anything or a security issue.
And
but
we should say Apple will push out security fixes at whenever necessary immediately,
right?
Right. Yeah.
Right. In fact, there were some security fixes along with this release for previous releases, too.
Right,
so,
right.
Yeah.
So the reason I mention that is Mark Gurman has tweeted, when Apple set out to develop iOS 17, which I guess would come out with the new iPhones in the fall, the initial thinking was to call it a tune-up release, one focused more on fixing bugs and improving performance and adding new features, kind of like they did with Snow Leopard back in 2009. The hope was to avoid the problems of iOS 16, which was an ambitious update that suffered from missed deadlines and a buggy start. But later in the development process, the strategy changed. I presume this is Gurman sources. The iOS 17 release is now expected to boast several nice-to-have features, and he puts nice-to-have in quotes, even if it lacks a tentpole improvement like last year's revamped lock screen. The goal of the software, codenamed Dawn, is to check off several of users' most requested features. He does not elaborate on which those features are.
I'll just point out that Snow Leopard, which everybody always uses as the baseline for this, like, let's have another Snow Leopard release where they just fixed things. Snow Leopard had, I think, hundreds of new features. Like, it's hard to keep the new features out. But I think that no big tentpole is maybe an example of this, where they're, like, doing quality of life improvements and bug fixes and also probably spending most of their engineers' time on the VR headset instead of the Core OS.
But yeah, we've heard rumors that they were
pulling
people off of the of teams to do the VR. Yeah.
Bug fix updates are great. Let's do it. I'm sold on that. We don't need the pace of innovation and pushing out new features and rewriting old apps has been great and messy. So I would welcome some small tweaks that make life better and some fixes and just letting I'm in the midst of running a survey for a bunch of IT professionals, and if I hear anything from them, it's like, slow it down.
Oh, yeah.
Like, the annual treadmill for if you're supporting a large number of devices is brutal. Like, I get why Apple does it, especially for the iPhone, but that Mac on an annual release cycle is really tough. So if they back off and just kind of let it cool down for a year, I think that's great.
Yeah.
And I'm hoping that they take another whack at Stage Manager, because they didn't when they debuted it last year, they didn't make a good enough case for people to leave it turned on. I think that I rarely see people actually using it in the wild. I don't think it's bad. I just think that it doesn't present an immediate sense of, oh, this is going to be inconvenient to learn this new thing, but oh boy, is it going to be worth it. And I would love to see them. This was the very first cut at the probably one of the most significant user interface updates and changes to iOS tandem with macOS since ever. So they're not going to get it right the first time. You could expect that's going to continue to evolve. So I'm interested to see, again, do they decide that let's just let this lay fallow and pretend that this didn't really exist? Or are they really energetically going to be piling on, okay, we have seen how people use it. We've seen what the complaints are. We ourselves have been dogfooding it. Here is some adjustments that we've made to how it works to make it seem more essential.
What would you want in an iOS 17? I mean, I agree with the IT folks. And by the way, we hear this on Windows as well. They say, we don't stop. Just make it good. Don't change it. Mm-hmm. Just make it good. Is there anything, though, that's missing from iOS 16 that we should have?
Yeah. I'd like them to move the iPad features or the iPhone features that aren't on the iPad to the iPad this year, which is like that. Move the lock screen and the widgets and stuff over there. There's
I
a bunch
agree
of
with
those.
That. That's good.
Things
yeah.
that they just didn't
they
bring to the
that.
iPad.
Yeah.
So that's an existing features moving. And then it's funny. It's actually I talked about this on my upgrade podcast with Mike Hurley on Monday. And then like later that day, Cable Sasser from Panic wrote a blog post about it. So it's in the water now, which is Apple has this amazing new password manager that they've been building for the last few years. And I actually have on my wish list, make it an app. Like it's hidden in the settings yeah. app, and trying to explain to a friend or family member that Apple has a password manager, but you have to dig down in settings. I would love to see Apple just kind of pull it out and make it an app so that you can point to it and say, look, your passwords go in that app that Apple is giving you. And they sync to all your devices, and it'll keep track of all your passwords, because it is a conceptual leap to explain that there's a subset in the settings app, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Siri's talking to us.
No, it's Carrot, unfortunately.
Carrot. Oh, it's Carrot.
Stop
oh, no.
it.
It's swearing. Don't swear. Yeah. Anyway, yeah. I like when I visit my mom, I got her off of her paper notebook that she's addicted to and onto Apple's password manager, half off. She still goes back to it. She relapses every now and then. But the biggest conceptual leap when I was trying to work it out with her was where you go to see it, not in Safari, but like where does it live? And I'm like, it's in the settings app. And she's like, it's very hard for her to take that conceptual leap, whereas pointing to her to an app has never been a problem. And I think that a lot of people are like that.
Do you think the reason that they don't make it an app is to keep it a little hidden, so that if you don't know what you're doing, you're not like exposing the passwords all the time, like, you know, like opening
Maybe.
Them up. And it feels like they do that to kind of like, hey, if you don't know what you're doing, we're going to keep it hidden and just kind of do it in the back end. And if you do know what you're doing, then we're going to let you play with it, but you could, you know, do damage if you're starting to cut
yeah, why
and paste
would you ever need
and,
to open it? Isn't the autofill sufficient?
Well, I mean, there are some sites where autofill doesn't work right.
Right.
And
yeah.
I find myself using the 1Password app all the time to dig in there. Plus the idea that you could leave yourself potentially like secure notes or just look up a password or whatever it is. I agree. There's a paternalistic kind of side to this, which is like, look, all we're doing is calling people on this. Maybe we don't want them to do that. And I think that I can see that argument. I just feel like at this point, it's so important that everybody use a password manager that getting in their faces with an app. I mean, there's a tips app, right? Like getting in their faces yeah. with a password app and saying, you need to use this for your passwords. I think they should. I think it's probably better that they do that.
I think the concern is that people will start doing things like, let me cut and paste that password and text it to you or email it to you or whatever, and you're more likely to do that when you know where the passwords are, and if you do know where they are,
well,
you know,
okay,
like you know, but if it's doing it in the background and kind of making it happen, you know, and you don't really understand it, it just gets you into what you need to get to as a kind of an average user or, you know, starter, it kind of protects you from yourself. And if you are geeky enough to get into the settings, they think, well, maybe you've graduated to the point where you can start cutting yeah. and password, cutting and pasting and sending.
So just for people who are listening and going, what are they talking about? In settings where you go to passwords, where you would think normally what you're doing is setting password settings, there's actually a list of all your passwords. And you can go there. You can create new passwords there. Just it looks just like a regular password manager.
Yeah. And there's also the Keychain Access app that most people don't use because this is a very nerdy. Oh, iOS? No, I'm sorry.
I agree
it's necessary on macOS as well. This is like a universal.
I mean, I do open Keychain, and that is an app.
Right.
But it's
doubly necessary on iOS.
Yeah. I like your first proposal, which is essentially, maybe Apple made a mistake separating iOS and iPadOS. Essentially, shouldn't all the features of iOS be common on both platforms or no?
They kind of are, aren't they?
Widgets are. What is it that you said they should have, Jason? You had a list of things.
Oh, well, I mean, on between iPad and iPhone, right?
Yes.
Like iPadOS versus iOS. They hold those features back.
Yeah.
That's the biggest thing. The Mac, at this point, the Mac and the iPad are kind of in lockstep, which I think is a good thing. And yeah. I know people, a lot of Mac users who are cranky old Mac users, which Andy and I are too, I think, although maybe not as cranky, remember, but it's not a Mac feature. It's this thing imported from the iPad. But like, do you remember the 2010s when the iPad and the iPhone got all these new features and the Mac either didn't get it for a year or two or got it, but only about half the features and the other half of the features just didn't work. And that doesn't happen anymore. So I'm very happy that the Mac and the iPad kind of move forward in lockstep now. That's pretty good. But I'm not happy that the iPhone gets these features and they're like, yeah, we could have brought it to the iPad, but nah, we didn't this year. It's literally the same operating system. But yeah, you don't get it. You don't get those customizable lock screens and lock screen widgets. Wait a year, maybe. So
Cable Sasser is the panic guy, software guy. Apple passwords deserve an app. It's in his blog at cablecabel.com. It's funny that they have all of this. They even have, don't they have 2FA in it too?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. So he's got some tweets. Do you know what Apple should do? Build a 2FA authenticator in iOS. It's already there. How about a password manager? It's already there. So I agree with Cable. I agree with you. Maybe they will. The problem is right now it's not cross-platform. So if you're an Android user, it's not going to do you any good. Windows, you can, right? Because doesn't the iCloud app now give you access to passwords in Windows? I think it does.
Mm. Yes.
Yeah.
In fact, it's more standalone than it is on the Mac or iOS.
Isn't that funny?
Yeah. But that is a reason why I think that users should have access to that sort of stuff, because sometimes you do have to the number of times where I've got my password for something on one password manager, but I need to use it on another device or another desktop that doesn't have cross compatibility. Yeah, then I do actually need to actually see the 18 digit random passcode that I had my password manager generate for me, because I'm not going to remember that stuff. So yeah. I give my consistent belief is that give people the ability to get themselves in trouble, but try to steer them away from it. But don't like say that, no, I'm not going to let you see that. I don't trust you enough to let you see what your own passwords are. So you'll thank me later. Like, no, I won't. I'll be angry at you now.
Mr. Cook has gone to China again. He is in China praising Apple's symbiotic relationship with China.
What a bad choice of words.
Oh, Lord above. But it is kind of true, right? At least until he can move all that manufacturing to Vietnam or India or Brazil.
Oftentimes when you're getting ready to leave is when you're the nicest.
Yeah. So we love you guys. Bye.
I think Apple's made a lot of moves.
Is Tim saying it's not me, it's you? No, it's not you, it's me. That's what he's saying.
I think it's a face-saving thing for China. Apple's moving a bunch of stuff out of it. People are panicked. The Chinese government is not something you want to cross, especially when all your eggs are in their basket. So I think that him showing up and saying great things while he's going to continue to diversify, I think probably makes business sense.
He is at the China Development Forum in Beijing, which Financial Times says the country's version of Davos. First time since the pandemic began. We could not be more excited, Cook said. Apple and China grew together, and so this has been a symbiotic kind of relationship. Who is the fungus and who is the tree? That's the question.
Well, if it's true symbiosis, right? They're both benefiting equals from this. I think that's a lot less weird than you might think, because what he's saying is Apple needs China and China needs Apple. China has benefited from Apple and Apple has benefited from China. And that is different than I think what is sometimes portrayed, which is that it's a one-way street, that Apple has made it big by being in China, but China could cut them off whenever they want. And I think that there is a case to be made that China has benefited from having Apple in its factories and also having Apple products available in its stores, where people in China can buy Apple products, which are good and well-liked products. So it is a symbiotic relationship. But yeah, it's also, don't feel bad. Yes, we talked about this before, but we're using the pandemic shutdowns as a good pretext to say, oh, we need to diversify our global reach. But not because we don't like you. It's because we just need diversification in general, when the truth is it's also let's not have everything in China.
Not because we don't like you, but because you're acting crazy.
Yeah.
We're trying again to know that. It's not you, it's me.
We wish China the best of luck in its future endeavors.
Meanwhile, China, in the shape of Chairman of National Development Reform Commission, Zheng Shanjie, said Apple needs to strengthen its data security and personal privacy protection. You need to do a better job.
Yeah, that was the only quote that we got from this meeting. Between a lot of the stuff that's coming out of this is group meetings between Tim Cook and other C-suite executives with China representatives. I think that the Reuters report has this as a one-on-one. I'm looking at the original Reuters report, and yeah, this is consistent with what they've been saying to pretty much every Western company, that when they talk about you need to tighten up your security, you need to be better controlled. A lot of it is truly giving your users better security than you're giving them in the United States, but a lot of them is that we have our own data protection practices that require you to have more of your data transacted by and landed in China if you're operating through Chinese citizens. And so basically, their idea is that the more data we can see, the more secure your data is. So there's a little bit of both going on there.
Yeah. The two sides exchange. And you're right. Reuters didn't say, but they implied that it was a one-on-one when Zheng Shanjie met with Apple CEO yesterday. But they didn't exactly say. Two sides. The statement from China's Ministry of Commerce says the two sides exchanged views on issues such as Apple's development in China and the stabilization of the industrial and supply chains. Do you think behind closed doors, Tim kind of took him by the lapels and said, "What?"
I do not.
No,
I don't think. I don't think Apple's gonna.
He stroked their hair and said,
"He's too good a diplomat for that."
Yeah, he's too good. I think that he has no interest, I think, in having any interaction with China that would be tense. Like, it's just like, "Hey, we're doing great. How do we move this forward? How do we do these things? Yeah, I know that we're moving out of the country. We have to, diversify." And it's easy to go into places like India that require, but Brazil and India require the production to be right in there. But, Vietnam is a little different. And I think that, China's got it. China will become more and more paranoid about this because everybody's trying to figure this out.
Right.
Tim Cook is a supreme politician, I think, when it comes to China. And I know during the last couple of years of the Trump administration, people said that he was basically the U.S. ambassador to China in some ways. Like, he was the one that the Chinese talked to the most. But obviously, he's got a real diplomatic challenge here. Like Alex said, you want to make it clear that they're not losing face, right? Because they know what's going on, right? They know that Apple's concerned that if there's a U.S.-China rupture, that Apple's entire business is going to be destroyed. And they know that Apple needs to show some diversification, even if it's just for the sake of Wall Street feeling more comfortable. But Tim Cook also knows that China doesn't want to feel like Apple is abandoning them. And so you play a game where everybody says the right thing and make sure that everybody feels good about what's going on, when we know what's going on, which is Apple's not leaving China, but Apple realizes it can't just be in China. And so, here we are.
Yeah, and they're also giving, Apple's also giving something valuable to China, which is these very, very public and enthusiastic statements of support. The economy in China is, I mean, it's having problems just like everybody else is having problems. The middle class is getting a lot more antsy than they were just 5 years ago, not just with the lockdowns, but with the state of the economy itself. So just like it was wise for Tim to allow Donald Trump to have a massive like campaign slash press event at an Apple factory in Texas, it's very much to Tim's and Apple's advantage to make sure that you have these statements in line, in which you're not simply waffling, you're not just simply, you're having open, frank and open communications, that you're being one of the speakers at this conference, and that you are 100% enthusiastic about the partnership that you've forged with this friendly nation, that you intend to keep on thriving strong together, hand in hand, marching forward until kingdom come. So this is just,
I feel again, like I should be humming patriotic music behind that, yeah, as Andy speaks.
Jason, you're absolutely right. I don't know any. It's amazing that you have two CEOs back to back at Apple with so completely opposite set of skills in this regard. You know, you would not consider the word diplomatic when it comes to Steve Jobs in any way, shape, or form. And yet the success that that Tim Cook has had is largely because he is able to simply let's keep my poker face. Here is a tactical relationship that is very, very good for both of us. Let's find a way to make sure this is a strong relationship where nobody's talking to Trump. Let's make sure that Apple is talking to Trump. If nobody's talking to China, let's make sure that at least Apple is talking to China. I wonder how deep that goes, because it's one of the greatest assets that Tim Cook can provide, his Rolodex and his handshake. It really, really moves a lot of money across the boardroom.
And I think that, you know, Apple wouldn't be here without Steve Jobs, and it wouldn't have grown to where it is now without Tim Cook. I think that those very two very different things. I agree with Andy that it was just in everyone here, I think. But I think that it's just, I don't think Steve could have gotten the company to the size that it is now without, you know, Tim Cook is what did that, you know. Yeah. And maybe we've had another breakthrough product, I don't know. Yeah. But the skill that he's had, Tim Cook would have told a lot of people to go fly a kite.
Or Steve Jobs would have. Yeah, Tim.
I'm sorry, I'm
amazed when the people say, oh, well, Tim Cook's legacy is the Apple Watch, or maybe it'll be the VR headset. It's like, Tim Cook's legacy. Maybe I'm special because I look at those quarterly reports every quarter. But let me tell you, Tim Cook's legacy is very clear. Apple is many, many times the size it was when Steve Jobs died. And Steve Jobs wasn't that engaged in that part of the company for several years before that. That is Tim Cook's legacy, is he has made Apple scale enormously and done it using, I mean, yes, the iPhone's been successful, but he's played that success and done a bunch of stuff on the operations side and changed the way Apple markets its products. And like, that's his legacy, is that Apple is not even remotely the company it was when he took over.
100%. I'm not even sure that he would have greenlit something like a car. I'm not sure that he would have been made as big a push into a lot of the product lines that they're pushing into right now, because it's weird that Apple's doing so many projects that are really speculative in nature, whose payoff is by no means assured or even suggested by the work that they're doing. So yeah, that's 100%.
I think Apple, though, does at the scale that it's working at, it can't, you know, like if you look at what happened before Apple showed up with Nokia, you just felt like their cell phone business was going to last forever. And then it was gone in a couple years. Like it was just that fast. And so I think that Apple still has to keep on playing with the next big thing and trying to figure out what something that can replace the size of the iPhone when it comes to revenue. And it may not be AR, may not be cars, but they have to be thinking about those things, because, you know, that. I think anybody who looks back at what happened when the iPhone was released realizes how quickly something can turn in a market, because that, for Motorola, for Nokia, for everyone, that was Armageddon, you know, and they didn't see it coming. They thought that it was foolish by Apple to do it. They thought there was no chance of that. I remember all these quotes of like, well, Apple's going to learn what it's like with the big boys. And same thing we saw with watches. You know, like it was like, Apple's going to learn this is a lot more complicated than they think it is. And then suddenly they rolled into it. But that market changed so quickly and just turned over. And so I think Apple has to keep on doing hard things. They have to keep on figuring that out. You know, they I think there's easier wins than AR and cars. I think that, again, we've talked about, I think that they just built some of the HomeKit stuff. They probably add another $15 billion a year to just selling thermostats and locks and cameras. You know, like it's just like, because a lot of people would just buy those because still none of them are working. Maybe someday.
Do you think there, so that's interesting contention that there's stuff that Tim Cook doesn't wish, you know, wishes Apple weren't doing but can't stop. He doesn't have 100% control over that. He can't say, no, I didn't want to do that. Never, let's not do that.
I think he would kill it. I think he would kill it if he didn't want to do it. I think both of those are pretty, there's going to be a self-driving car, electric car, or just even electric car, but most likely a self-driving car in the next decade that a lot of people are going to start using. It doesn't have to be that they don't have to own the market to make a lot of money doing that.
And it's just prudent to do that work. They have the money to do it. It's prudent to do the work, right?
It's a good bet.
Yeah. You're hedging the market, because the problem is with both AR and with cars, the development time to get it right is so long.
They could
not have a company left by the time they figured out how to do it. So you have to kind of play that game along, unless you're just going to buy into the market. And that's not what Apple wants to do. They want to do it their way. They don't want to buy something. They did it with Beats, but they really just needed iTunes, or they just needed music, and the headphones didn't mean anything to them.
When Satya Nadella took over at Microsoft, he wasted no time to kill some things he just didn't want to do, including quite famously a product they were about to reveal, and he just said, no, put that back in the warehouse. They'd already made them. So, you know, it's not unheard of for a guy to come in. But I guess it'd be different, though, for Tim, given that Steve just passed, and it was like, you know, he's got Johnny Ive to deal with. It might have been politically difficult for him to do the same kind of scythe wielding. Anyway, let's take a break. I want to take a little break because I do want to talk about the headsets. I know we're kind of endlessly talking about that, but we should. There's a new Apple, long announced, finally out Apple product we can talk about in just a bit. And I left out something. I forgot that they updated Ventura too. So if there's anything to say about that, it sounds like it's much of the same stuff that they updated with 16.4 on iOS. But we can talk about that. But first, a word from us about sponsorship. Hey, everybody. Leo Laporte here. I am the founder and one of the hosts at the TWIT Podcast Network. I want to talk to you a little bit about what we do here at TWIT, because I think it's unique. And I think for anybody who is bringing a product or a service to a tech audience, you need to know about what we do here at TWIT. We've built an amazing audience of engaged, intelligent, affluent listeners who listen to us and trust us when we recommend a product. Our mission statement as TWIT is to build a highly engaged community of tech enthusiasts. Already your ears should be perking up at that, because highly engaged is good for you. Tech enthusiasts, if that's who you're looking for, this is the place. We do it by offering them the knowledge they need to understand and use technology in today's world. And I hear from our audience all the time, part of that knowledge comes from our advertisers. We are very careful. We pick advertisers with great products, great services, with integrity, and introduce them to our audience with authenticity and genuine enthusiasm. And that makes our Host Red ads different from anything else you can buy. We are literally bringing you to the attention of our audience and giving you a big, fat endorsement. We like to create partnerships with trusted brands who are in it for the long run, long-term partners that want to grow with us. And we have so many great success stories. Tim Broom, who founded IT Pro TV in 2013, started advertising with us on day one, has been with us ever since. He said, quote, "We would not be where we are today without the TWIT network." I think the proof is in the pudding. Advertisers like IT Pro TV and Audible that have been with us for more than 10 years, they stick around because their ads work. And honestly, isn't that why you're buying advertising? You get a lot with TWIT. We have a very full service attitude. We almost think of it as kind of artisanal advertising, boutique advertising. You'll get a full service continuity team,
people who are on the phone with you, who are in touch with you, who support you from with everything from copywriting to graphic design. So you are not alone in this. We embed our ads into the shows. They're not added later. They're part of the shows. In fact, often they're such a part of our shows that our other hosts will chime in on the ad saying, yeah, I love that. Or just the other day, one of our hosts said, man, I really got to buy that. That's an additional benefit to you because you're hearing people our audience trusts saying, yeah, that sounds great. We deliver, always over deliver on impressions. So you know you're going to get the impressions you expect. The ads are unique every time. We don't pre-record them and roll them in. We are genuinely doing those ads in the middle of the show. We'll give you great onboarding services. Ad tech with PodSites, that's free for direct clients, gives you a lot of reporting, gives you a great idea of how well your ads are working. You'll get courtesy commercials. You actually can take our ads and share them across social media and landing pages. That really extends the reach. There are other free goodies too, including mentions in our weekly newsletter that's sent to thousands of fans, engaged fans who really want to see this stuff. We give you bonus ads and social media promotion too. So if you want to be a long-term partner, introduce your product to a savvy, engaged tech audience. Visit twit.tv/advertise. Check out those testimonials. Mark McCrary is the CEO of Authentic. You probably know him, one of the biggest original podcast advertising companies. We've been with him for 16 years. Mark said the feedback from many advertisers over 16 years across a range of product categories, everything from razors to computers, is that if ads and podcasts are going to work for a brand, they're going to work on Twitch shows. I'm very proud of what we do because it's honest, it's got integrity, it's authentic, and it really is a great introduction to our audience of your brand. Our listeners are smart, they're engaged, they're tech savvy, they're dedicated to our network, and that's one of the reasons we only work with high integrity partners that we've personally and thoroughly vetted. I have absolute approval on everybody. If you've got a great product, I want to hear from you. Elevate your brand by reaching out today at advertise@twit.tv. Break out of the advertising norm. Grow your brand with host-read ads on twit.tv. Visit twit.tv/advertise for more details, or you can email us advertise@twit.tv if you're ready to launch your campaign now. I can't wait to see your product. So give us a ring. All right. Back we come to the meat of the matter, BNPL. Buy now, pay later. Apple announced it was going to do this. When did it announce that? Like in the fall, right? A while ago. It's finally launching.
Oh.
It's funny because there is a lot of people saying BNPL, buy now, pay later, is not consumer friendly. It's not good. Consumers may like it, but it gets them into financial trouble. The way Apple's doing it maybe is not so dangerous. You can use
it's
a service.
Short. It's like 6 weeks.
Yeah, right? 6 weeks. It's 50, loans of $50 to $1,000. I presume to buy an Apple product, but then you have four payments over the course of 6 weeks. That's not exactly a long term to pay it back with no interest or fees.
Yeah, maybe that's how they're hoping to not be hoodwinking their customers into going underwater. You'd be really, really scared if they said you got 2 years to pay. Here's the APR.
Yeah.
And now you're basically getting people to pay $3,000 for like
something
a
they can't afford.
Laptop.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Exactly. It would be an interesting thing if it's like, I know that you're going to be buying a phone sometime in the next 3 months. I know that you're in the 3 months in which you're saving up for it. We don't want to take the risk that you may buy a different phone or you might buy a different laptop. So we will let you buy it now. And then at the point where you were planning to buy it anyway, you will be able to pay it off. As usual, I wish I really knew what Apple's end game was for banking. It doesn't seem like the only way it makes sense for me is if they see this as a way to sell more Macs, sell more hardware, sell more services. Because if they really do want to get into the credit game, that's a scary place for them to be. That's so antithetical to a lot of the historical points of view that Apple has had. I don't see them being being a moneylender. I don't see them being a rent collector. I don't see them being like renting a sofa and then taking it back 8 months later and leaving people on the hook for $5,000 for the payments. And those are the things you sort of associate with these other credit card issuers. So I hope that they don't get. I hope that they don't wind up in another AirTag situation where it gives them nothing but bad press.
I'm sure Goldman Sachs is underwriting it, right? But The Verge found a little fine print you may be interested to hear. According to Apple, users can apply for this loan within the Apple Wallet, quote, with no impact on their credit, end quote. But the company notes in the fine print that the pay later loan and payment history, quote, may be reported to credit bureaus and impact their credit. So. It will impact your credit.
I think that the issue there is that they said it originally because I think that's probably what they believed. And then what's happened is that that's not
you can't do it. That's not how it works.
Or the check doesn't, but if you fail to pay, it absolutely does. Something like that. Yeah. I don't know. I mean, Andy, I totally see your point, but I feel like what Apple is doing here is actually a different quintessentially Apple thing, which is they're looking at the success of buy now, pay later services with certain age groups and saying, well, we could let somebody else administer that program, or we could just do it ourselves and control it all, which is a very Apple thing to do. But I see your point. Like, it is a weird choice, too. Maybe it was one of the easier things for them to do. But Apple doing, you know, being its own bank and doing all these other things that we've heard rumored, this is a strange sort of thing to roll out. But, you know, then again, I think Apple's found that disrupting the financial industry and the banking industry is a lot harder than disrupting the cell phone industry was, because what Apple Pay just launched in South Korea, I think, just this week or this month. And that, like, Apple Pay in South Korea in a major market. And yet it's limited to like one card in South Korea. So there's all sorts of, I don't know, I owe to be a fly on the wall of the Apple financial team and hear about what they choose to prioritize or what they choose to launch just because it's the thing that they could manage to get.
I bet there's a whole building of lawyers because financial and banking regulations.
Only one?
Maybe a couple of buildings. This is complicated stuff. I know because I watched Billions on Showtime, and I remember he really wanted to be a bank and all
it's
the
Paul
things.
Paul Giamatti.
Yeah.
It's like, wait a second.
Well, I think that this is a really, I mean, I think if you look at, I still think that if you look at Apple Pay, you know, they let somebody else administer that this is Apple Financial Services or it's a sub, they have their own thing that they're managing.
I think it's Goldman, right? Goldman's probably. Wait
No,
Apple's handling it by itself.
This is their pilot project of their own, be their own bank.
It's by a new subsidiary called Apple Financing, LLC.
Limited liability. Very careful
limited
there.
Limited liability.
So, but I think that and Apple has the money to back this up. They, you know, it'll be interesting to see. There's still, Apple is one of the only companies in the world, and it would be very, like, is one of the only companies in the world that could build a closed loop system where they're offering you credit and then, you know, offering people savings all inside of the same pipeline. And it just feels like they're sneaking up on it. You know, like they're just adding one more little thing. Let's figure this out for a little while. Let's one more little thing.
This is very slow, though, toe in. This is only available on iPhones and iPads and to a random selection of users.
But this is a very complicated thing. And I think I still feel like Apple is just kind of figuring this out slowly because they know how dangerous and deep the water is. But there's a lot of people that are not, you know, there's a lot of people that just don't care about their bank. Like, you know, and I think that Apple looks at that like, you know, the banks don't do what they do very well. Apple thinks that it can do it better. It builds a very tight relationship. And if you look at larger financial things like cars and other things like that, being able to provide that financing as well as provide savings opportunities to make that all work is not something like typically banks can't afford to do that kind of, I mean, banks we just saw recently having large deposits are not necessarily the safest thing in the world. Smaller deposits are not very profitable, but if you're just cutting out 1 or 2% of interest or taking that 1 or 2% of interest out of it, out of the system, it could be very profitable for a company like Apple. I mean, it could be billions and billions of dollars that they get kind of
by cutting everybody else out slowly. And so I think that it still feels like Apple is just kind of, I know it sounds crazy, but it looks like they're really sneaking up on this horse. So
despite the fact that Apple has a new subsidiary, the company partnered with the BNPL program MasterCard Installments to enable it, while, quote, Goldman Sachs is the issuer of the MasterCard payment credentials. So it's a little bit of Apple, a little bit of other things as
well.
It's
the easiest way to do it. It's the easiest way to dip your toe into that.
Oh, absolutely. I really think there probably is a debate within Apple about, there's a lot of profit here, but there's also a lot of risk, both reputationally and otherwise. The Consumer Financial Protection Bureau identified several areas of risk of consumer harm in BNPL programs, including inconsistent consumer protections, a prevalence of data harvesting, and a risk of debt accumulation, which, of course, is always the risk with all of these. By the way, good job, Emma Roth at The Verge on her reporting on this. A lot of inside stuff. So this, you know, and this makes me wonder also about the savings account, because when before 16.4 came out, when it was still in beta, there was a lot of conversation about stuff in the code referring to kind of accounts. There, 16.4 had references to routing and account numbers, current balance, interest earned, data management, funds available for withdrawal, and more. Have we seen anything in 16.4, the release, that indicates Apple savings is happening imminently, or it still hasn't happened, right? I can't still
I think so.
Still don't have that high yield savings account. I know, Alex, you've said for a long time Apple should be a bank.
I'm saying they should. I'm saying they are. They're going to.
I'm not saying that they should.
I'm saying that I can see these trajectories, and it just, wow, it doesn't look like, why would you do any of the things you're doing if you weren't going to become a bank? Like, that's the thing, is that, so if you weren't going to become a bank, you wouldn't do any of these things. And so it just, I'm not saying that Apple should do it. I'm just saying that they could, and they really look like they are. 5 years
right now, they're just doing what merchants do. They're not doing, well, the savings account would be what a bank does, of course.
Yeah.
And Apple Pay, to the degree that you could pay others. You can't pay bills with it yet, right? I mean, I pay my hairdresser with it.
I pay the same hairdresser with it.
Yes, that's right.
Apple Pay.
We have the same hairdresser.
So, but I keep a bunch of money in Apple Pay all the time, because that's kind of my, I can
oh my
use
God.
It all the time. I don't have to,
have,
you know, and so
I have $1,738 in my wallet. That's because I accumulate, you know, 1%, 2%, and 3% when I make purchases. Wow.
Time to transfer some of it back to your bank.
I might take that back. Is it insured? Is it FDIC insured? Is this like being in Silicon Valley Bank?
Yeah. Apple Pay Later starts today to, as we said, they're making offers to select users. Did we mention that that's loans of $50 to $1,000? So we're really talking about can't afford those AirPods. We'll help you with that.
Yeah.
Can't afford not the best iPhone, but a iPhone. We'll help you with that.
Sense in that case. It's a merchant feature. It's just like layaway, right? It's something merchants do as a convenience to help sell stuff, especially since it's not 6 months, it's 6 weeks.
So the argument is that Gen Z, you know, likes this sort of thing. I'm not sure I buy that argument. I think the more the argument is Gen Z is young and doesn't have a lot of cash right now and wants those AirPods. And so we can close the deal by splitting the cost over 3 payments 2 weeks apart or whatever. Like, that's the story here. And it is, you know, it makes me uncomfortable because it feels actually like it's probably not what it's being sold as, which is, a new way to pay that a new generation likes, and probably more the same old story, which is it's a financial instrument designed to get as much money extracted from 20-somethings who don't have a big bank account as possible.
And I think a lot of it is that they go for the AirPod Pro instead of the AirPod because it's, you know, they can figure that out. It's less of like they're taking a big bite, but they're like, I'll buy something that's $50 more. I can't do that right now, but if I split it up, I can spread it out.
Danger, children, danger. I encourage my kids not to do that, but as I'm sure most parents do. We just told Michael, he just got his first credit card. We said, pay it off every month. Don't run a balance. That's a That's a recipe for disaster. And I know that from personal experience. I mean, I got to a point in my 30s where I had, I don't know, $20,000 or $30,000 in credit card debt. At that point, the interest is so high that you're real almost not paying off the credit card. It just goes and goes and goes. It's not a good thing. Save your pennies. But see, that's what I'm doing now, my Apple Wallet. When I get to $3,000, I can buy the new M3 MacBook Pro. I just realized I'm saving
I did
money.
Try to, I will say that I think the transfer cap, I believe, is about $2,000 Apple Pay, only because I went to buy something from a friend of mine for $6,000 or $5,000, and Apple Pay was like,
No, you can't
transfer $5,000 over Apple Pay. They were like,
Can you transfer that money into your bank account though?
Yeah.
Yeah. They don't,
you can
they
transfer
just,
your
you
money out of your bank account into Apple Pay. You can go,
you can
just send it. Oh, yeah. That's what I did because I moved it from my bank account to Apple Pay, and then I tried to just send him Apple Pay.
You can't just do it in one transaction.
Scanner that I was getting. And
you have to do, well, Venmo's like that. You have to do $1,000 at a time.
Yeah.
At Apple, there's, according to the New York Times, rare dissent over a new product. I think the New York Times is a little late on this, frankly. Trip Mickle and Brian X. Chen. The company is expected to unveil an augmented reality headset in a few months. Some employees wonder if the device makes sense for Apple. Didn't Gurman have this story like 3 weeks ago?
Financial Times had it last week, I think.
Last week. Okay, so Tripp and Brian are finally getting around to it.
But they had, I think the information about the demo in front of like high executives.
The 100 people. Yes, that was Gurman, right? Yeah. 100 Apple.
Yes.
The top 100 Apple executives came to the Steve Jobs Theater last week to see, not for the first time, but to see this new product, which Apple will presumably be offering for $3,000 in June.
Yeah, that's the scary thing about it was that the description of the video, they showed a video that was along the lines of like a promo video. And so the video showed a man in a London taxi donning an augmented reality headset and calling his wife in San Francisco. "Would you like to come to London?" he asked. Two people who saw the video. Soon the couple were sharing the sights of London through the husband's eyes.
Oh, Lord.
So
that is awful.
I will say that I think that something got convoluted there. I know that that's what they reported, but that happened. Something almost identical like that was reported to have happened in 2018.
Yeah.
Like where they didn't even have the device yet. And Johnny Ive was still like pushing this, and there was a big thing. So I think that it's.
Oh yeah. In fact, no, the Times says this was 5 years ago. It says that.
So
when Apple had a corporate retreat in Carmel Valley about 5 years ago to discuss the next major product, Johnny Ive captivated a room with a concept video. That was 5 years ago.
So that was, I think that was in a different time when they had a different expectation of what they were going to be able to get done in 5 years. They're not going to get that right now. And I think that they were trying to create some imagination there.
Well, but also, as time goes by, I think we're less and less. Does that sound appealing? Is that a feature you can't wait to get so that you can get in a taxi?
There are a lot of features, and I have to admit that I have done a lot of AR and VR work, and
you're our expert. Yeah.
So I can tell you that there's a lot of things that'll be really exciting. One of the problems that Oculus had, we were part of the training team for the Oculus camera. So I definitely know a lot about the capture and the process and everything else. And the one of the real challenges with Oculus in general was the frame rate wasn't high enough to be compelling. And the development process was really hard, and the video acquisition was very hard, and so everything was hard to create content for it. I don't know if it's as much anymore. I haven't done it for Oculus for a while, but the content development process was very difficult. The frame rate was too low, the resolution was too low, and they burned up all the people that were really excited about it with something that just really wasn't there. It was like 320 by 240 video. Now, what I can say is that there are headsets that, haven't been released that have much higher frame rate and much higher resolution. And you can't gauge what the success of the current one is without seeing the ones. I don't know what Apple's going to do, but if the frame rate is over 95 frames a second, let's just say 120 frames per second. And if the video is 6K per eye or more, it's a much different experience than anything people have seen up until now. And so if Apple's able to do that, it's going to be a really interesting thing. The other real problem has been development. And Apple's been building up all the USDZ and all the AR tools and all the other stuff, because it was only a handful of us were doing it very well when it came to like live interaction with Oculus, because it was really a heavy lift. You're in Unity or in Unreal and you're building these things out, and it's not trivial to put those things together. And so I think that was a real, they built a huge canal with no water, you know? And so I think that there are a lot of challenges. And the biggest thing with Oculus was, not the biggest thing, but one of the big things is configuration. When you put the headset on is really important. When you put it on, it has to do something and you have to understand where you're going. And a lot of people had a problem with that. You put it on and now you're in some state and you're trying to figure out how to explain it to somebody or how to do X, Y, and Z. One of the advantages that Apple has is that they have a phone that can connect to it. They have an Apple TV that can connect to it. They have a lot of things that can say you're in a state at your Apple TV. Let's say you're watching MLS. Would you like to stand next to the goal for this next little bit? Throw your headset on and boom, you're there. You know, and I think that, and they can do that because they're the broadcaster for MLS. They can tell them, they can put cameras wherever they want. They don't have to negotiate with anybody. They're going to say, we're going to put a camera here and here and here, and we're going to be able to give you that. But it's not, people are always like, well, how are you going to do that for hours? You're not, maybe it's 15 minutes. Maybe it's a minute. Maybe it's 3 minutes. I'm going to have a bigger experience in that moment. And I think that there's a lot of places that, you know, when we were doing a lot of the stuff that I've worked on hasn't made it to the public, but I can tell you there were a lot of things that we were like, oh, this, we would do this all the time. It was just expensive and hard to do. And it wasn't ready for prime time because the technology wasn't fast enough to do it. But I think that there's a lot. I mean, when people say there's no solution or there's nothing people want to do with AR, we've only seen very, very small and rough versions of what's there. I think there's a lot of really interesting things that people are really going to be interested in to play with as that rolls out. And I think that the biggest mistake Apple will make if they don't execute it is funding development of content. Like they have to go full out. They blew it with books. You know, books, they went to Pearson and gave them money to do something stupid.
Yeah.
You know, and it was completely a disaster. And they didn't build the tools that were necessary for books to be successful. Like they could have designed something that was way beyond books, and that's not what they got. So if they really fund, you know, I think that Unreal has done, I mean, Epic has done an amazing job with their Megafund. I mean, it got everyone stopped thinking about anything else and started developing for Megafunds because they could get $25,000 almost, you know, and all those are grants. They're not investments. So you can get $25,000, $250,000, $500,000, $1 million. And people are developing all the time for it. And so I think that Apple really, I think we should be careful of saying that Apple, that there's no market here. I think there's a pretty big market here. I think that at $3,000, it's going to be a very small market to start with, but Apple has to get user interface. They have to get user feedback before they go any further. They can't keep developing this in a lab with like 10 people using it. They have to get it out there. They have to, you know, take some scrapes. They have to like figure it out. And they have, and I think it's smart to actually charge a lot for it so that you can have the performance that is inspiring and you're not dealing with just average people putting it on and going, I don't understand. You know, it's people who are investing real money in it and getting performance that you just can't put into a $1,000 headset. So I think it's going to be interesting. I think it's going to.
You're the bull. I'm the bear. I think this is such a waste of time and money for Apple. What's interesting is apparently Mark Gurman's turning into a little bit of a bear. He says, with a headset, Apple will have to explain to consumers why they'd want to own such a product at all. Moreover, the device will start around $3,000, lack a clear killer app, require an external battery that will need to be replaced every couple of hours, and use a design that some testers have deemed uncomfortable. It's also likely to launch with limited media content.
Yeah, I mean, show me the lie, right? I mean, he's not wrong, although the killer app thing is weird because very rarely does a new hardware product launch with a killer app. You launch it and then the world provides a killer app or doesn't, and you kind of hope you build a product that will be able to enable a killer app. But other than that, he's not wrong. I always think of Mark Gurman as the person who has good sources inside Apple, but is not being sort of like used by Apple to get, you know, for its purposes. Although I know I said a few weeks ago that some of his reporting was doing exactly what Apple wanted, which is to show that it's being responsible when it's cutting back on costs and not, you know, using attrition and not filling open jobs and all of that. But this one, not just Mark's report, but a couple of these other reports that I've seen in the last couple of weeks, I find, how shall I put this, suspiciously useful to set expectations low for the Apple VR headset. It feels like, I don't know whether Apple's really behind it in a concerted way or not, but I'm seeing a lot more reports that are like, oh, but it's going to be expensive and it's going to be a slow build like the Apple Watch.
Just
it's
to
not
going to
be
you.
There at launch.
Yeah.
And like that totally serves Apple's purposes if this product is what we think, right? You don't want the hype cycle to be like, oh my God, it's the next iPhone and everybody's going to buy one, when the truth is they don't think they're going to sell a million and it's going to cost $3,000 and they're really playing a long game. So whether the people inside Apple are just saying that to Mark Gurman and he's reflecting it, or whether there is a more concerted effort on Apple's part to lower expectations, it really has felt for me in the last couple of weeks like the expectations are all being suppressed in a lot of these reports. And that, like I said, I don't know if Apple's doing that on purpose, but it certainly serves them well to have everybody not expect this to be the thing that changes the world. Mm. We'll see. But like it just my spider sense went off with this latest one where
Isn't
I'm like, now, wait a second.
Yeah.
How much expectation management is going on here?
Yeah,
I wonder.
I do think that the review cycle on this is going to be so completely predictable, where Apple's going to announce this, and then for the first week, cover of every virtual magazine everywhere saying Apple, oh my God, this is did what Zuckerberg couldn't, the next revolution is here. Cycle two, people actually get them and see that it doesn't actually do anything, because now it's more truthful but also more marketable. If you're writing a story, say, oh, Apple's finally fallen on its face, look how little this thing does for $3,000, and hey, look, we're doing a side-by-side comparison between that and this $800 Oculus, and look how much better the Oculus is at the exact same tasks. And then people are going to forget about it for about 8 or 9 months, and then Apple will come out with the actual thing.
Okay, good. Yep. All right, we'll make a note, put a pin in that, and we'll come back in 8 months or 18 months or however long, and we'll
that, that said, it's still very speculative.
Yeah.
As a product, just like the car, I think is speculative.
They can afford it, but except that, you know, the difference is they're releasing it. So the car,
exactly.
It's all under wraps. Now they're releasing it, and I think there is going to be a drumbeat saying Apple has fallen on its face, and Tim Cook, what are you doing? There's going to be that. You're right, and
inevitable.
It's inevitable.
But I do think that it'll be, and. You know, I believe that Apple has been probably spending a lot of time and money on developing proof, you know, that killer, not the killer apps, but apps that are going to really push the envelope of what the headset can do. I just can't believe that they would do something for this long without working on that. I do think that there's some tests that if they show it, like if you took this headset to, let's say, the Gettysburg battlefield. I've been there a lot. So I grew up in Pennsylvania. And you go there and you walk up to Pickett's, where Pickett's Charge was, and you put a headset on and
that
you get to
cool.
see what the battle looked like.
Yeah.
But you get to see what the battle looked like. You hear things. People are going past you. You'll want that for every historical place that you went. And it's not that you leave it on the whole time. You're not walking around the battlefield with it, but you walk over to a little point on the ground and you put it on and you feel like you're there. Or if you're at a sporting event and you feel like you're on the sidelines, or you feel like, and again, it's not, I don't think it needs to be. What we found in most of the work that we did is, number one app, by the way, watching movies is very popular in planes on Oculus. Like that's the people just want to put the headset on and forget everybody's there and go watch a movie. So that's kind of table stakes, but a lot of use cases are 5 minutes or less. You know, you put them on, you experience something, you take them off. And I think that the thing is that, you know, developers will have to make a decision. But the one thing I will say is the problem with this is not, it might be some of the development issues. But the really hard part about AR and VR is that you have to learn how it works. It takes many, many cycles to learn how to build content for it. There's all kinds of things everybody does when they first start. And you can't do most of those things over time. And so the developers that get into it early and bet on it. And if it turns out successful, they'll be the ones that sell for hundreds of millions of dollars. Like the, you know, the other, but it'll be, you know, that, so there's going to be, you know, there's going to be the first run really makes a difference because you don't know which way is up when you start developing this content. Now they'll go grab a lot of people that have done stuff for Oculus and so on and so forth. But I think that, you know, this is really aimed at the developers. This is aimed at the developers. This is aimed at industrial. This is aimed at those things, the people who want to get in early and figure this out and figure out how to develop for it and figure out how to create cool things. And I think there's a lot of cool things they can create. And I think that we haven't seen most of them. We've just done enough tests that I know there's a lot of things that I did that I would totally use if it was higher frame rate and higher resolution.
All right. As I said, I'm the bear on this one. You're the bull. We'll see who's right sooner or later, mostly likely later. And that's good. It's a good caution that in a few months, you will be hearing us laughing, mocking, throwing eggs at the Apple VR headset. Don't believe
it. What I will say is there's going to be a lot of money floating around in Sand Hill for shovel-ready if Apple releases it, shovel-ready projects in
maybe
the Bay Area.
If there's anything left after all the AI investments, maybe.
Yeah,
this is the problem, is that something came along all of a sudden nobody expected, and everybody's jumped on that bandwagon.
Yeah, and the thing is, Microsoft and OpenAI and Google can all point to something that will solve problems immediately. Like, okay, you've got 5,000 emails in your inbox. 100 of them are related to a project that you've been working on, collaborating with three people on for the past 4 weeks. You need to summarize what you've agreed on, what the timetable is. Good luck looking through all those 5,000 emails, or you could just simply ask our new Gmail-enabled AI to simply say, find everything about this project, summarize it, and basically produce a summary for it immediately. I don't think that means that that's going to be like the death of Apple by any means, but it's an interesting time for Apple to say, we've got this thing that, trust us, it's awesome. You can watch movies on it like an iPhone. Not like an iPhone. Better than an iPhone. Everything about this better than an iPhone.
I mean, the example you just gave, like, that's not Apple's market. Like, they don't care about that market. Like, they don't, you know, like, so that's the, like, they're cared.
The only thing right now that anybody does VR with is games. That's not that they aren't going to have games. They might have, you know, like Monument Valley level games. They're not going to have AAA titles. So they're not going to have
games. They're not going to have AAA titles, but they are going to have games. Even if they have to pay people to make games for their platform, they will do it, whether they're there on, you know, month one or whether it takes a while. Anyway, my vote for which of you is right, by the way, in the Great Bear and Bull discussion is Andy. Andy's right. The hype cycle will happen. And I don't know if we'll know for years whether anybody is right or wrong, because this first product is just not going to be one worth judging, because it's going to be a developer kit, essentially. So we're really not going to know what regular people are not going to buy a $3,000 thing. So it's like step zero, square zero. We're not at square one yet. That probably won't be for another year or two. Yeah.
And that's one of the things Kerman said. It's going to be like the Apple Watch, which took a while to gain traction.
Well, basically not just to gain traction. Apple, as I said before, Apple guessed wrong as to what people would think about this watch. And basically everyone after a year told them, no, you gave us a fitness watch. I know you think you gave us an extension of the iPhone. I know you think you gave us the next step in mobile computing. What you gave us was a fitness watch. Thank you for the fitness watch. Now improve the features of this wonderful fitness watch. And then Apple said, yes, we are geniuses. We made this wonderful fitness watch. Because stay tuned, we'll be improving the fitness watch. I'm sure this is going to be the same way for the VR set.
Well, I just hope I'm still around when the VR takes off. So you can all tell me how
we'll
wrong
stick one
I
over
was.
Your head in the home. Leo, it's here. It's here. You can
I
want
to go
want
to
again.
London.
Let's do it.
Now, of course, it will just be a milk carton with a ViewMaster inside it.
I'll be impressed.
But we know it'll make you happy. You know, it's
Apple's threatening to take action against staff who don't come into the office. This is just Scrooge light. A lot of companies are doing this. You got to show up. And it's always management that wants this. And workers go, God, I don't want to come into the office. This is from Zoe Schiffer at Platformer. They according to Zoe, again, it's not, you know, according to Zoe, Apple is tracking employee attendance via badge records and will give employees escalating warnings if they don't come in three times a week.
That's the new reporting, right? We already heard this last week that they were leaning on people, and it's like a part of their, you know, we're saving money and we're making sure that you're following our rules. But the detail that they're doing badge tracking, I also wonder if maybe the badge tracking is really not ratting out the employees, but is ratting out the managers, right? Like their managers are like, wink, wink, nudge, we know you don't need to come in. You can take Wednesday at home and I don't mind. And then the badges don't lie, right? And they're like, I wonder about that. That was my, and then immediately what I thought was, well, I wonder how many wink, wink, nudge, nudge agreements there are with managers and their employees. And that if they're going to the card reader records, that strikes me as being Apple trying to root out like the managers who are not following the policy, not the employees. But who knows?
Here's a petition, appletogether.org. Tell Apple we demand location flexible work. 1,250 people have signed, although anybody can sign. So I don't know how many of those are actually Apple employees.
Yeah. Part of this might be that when they built that brand new campus, they basically got some tax breaks, some financial advantages that were tied to commitments to having X number of employees coming in to use that facility. And if they don't make those targets, they might have to give some money back, or they might lose some advantages. Yeah. So there's a lot to unpack here with all these different companies insisting that employees actually start to work back in the office. And some of it really is based on teams, but a lot of them is based on commitments that the company has made that are really, really complicated that they never thought they would have to default on just because they're having trouble getting their employees to simply come back to work.
Good news.
I mean, there's a big
go ahead.
No, I was just saying that, you know, the ecosystem, you know, there's an ecosystem around all of these headquarters that has lots of restaurants and lots of other things. And they're probably, you know, upset that is going to. But on the same side, I mean, there's so many things playing against it. It's not just people wanting to work at home. The open office is an unmitigated disaster. Like, it's probably the worst architectural idea or work management idea in the last century. And, you know, it's just, I don't know how anyone thinks straight, you know, when they're in that experience. I think that if most companies just gave up, said, hey, we're getting rid of the open office, we're going to give you little cubes that are, let's say, eight feet by eight feet that are going to have a virtual, you know, they're going to have a camera in them. You can jump into the meetings and everything else. Because the other thing you have to realize is that when you're there, it's not just the open office, it is the battle for the conference rooms. You know, all of these companies have these conference rooms. There's not enough conference rooms for everybody. So everybody sits there and they're trying to schedule their 30 minutes. And there's people like literally you're 1 minute over and there's people stacked outside the window, like waiting for you to get out so they can get into there and do theirs. And there's so much stress that goes on with all of these things of trying to get into the conference room and trying to get out of the conference room and then trying to think straight when people are talking to you and all these other things that if they gave people their own little spaces, that they don't have to listen to everybody, that they can jump in. The meetings would be easier to do securely, let's say on campus. You could say some of them are only on campus and so that you're only using the infrastructure internally. It would be easier to do all these conferences and talk to each other more by not having to walk over to this campus or that campus and try to get into this conference room or that conference room. It really is the way that these companies have set up their offices is just a mess, you know. And in addition to that, you either spend an enormous amount of money on really bad real estate in the Cupertino area. You know, it's like $1 million for a shack. Like, I don't even know if it comes with plumbing for $1 million. And so people can either pay an incredible sum for a really bad house, or they can move out and not have and be 2 or 3 hours away, and now they have a reasonable house, but getting into the office is no small thing. And it's just so the quality of life for the employees, and they just suddenly realized how good it could be. And I think Apple's already lost a lot. I know people that are no longer working at Apple only because of the travel policy. Like, mm-hmm. Literally they were just like, no, I'm not coming in. And they said, well, you have to come in. And they said, well, I quit. And I have enough stock to, they don't need the work. they have plenty of time to do whatever they want to do. And that's the, and so I think Apple's already had a bit of a brain drain from some key. I mean, there's some teams that I feel like got eviscerated, you know, by people who just didn't want to come back in.
Good news. Piper has been acquired and Apple is now in possession of Middle Out Compression. Very big story here. No, I'm just kidding. Apple acquired a startup using AI to compress videos. Of course it's using AI. Everything's using AI these days. Wave One.
If you want it to be funded, it's using AI.
I'm using AI.
Whatever. Oh, yeah. Yeah. We got it. We got AI. I built a whole chat app.
In AI. Yeah.
Sure. It's got AI.
Wavelength.
Right.
Wave One's website was shut down around January because apparently Apple, which never says, bought them but didn't tell anybody, nor did Wave One. Oh, wait a minute. Here's a LinkedIn post published a month ago by the former head of sales and business development, and that's why he's former, that the company has now. It was founded in 2016. They set out to take the decades-old paradigm of video codecs and make them AI-powered. Back then, deprioritize shrubbery, focus on faces and texts. It's that simple. That's how
I mean, I love the idea here, right? Which is that our traditional codecs are all based on
each pixel.
Analysis.
Every pixel counts. Matters. Yeah.
And so what if you had an algorithm, because you can't, a person would not be able to do this, right? It would be frame by frame, but like an AI that can prioritize every single, an algorithm anyway, that can prioritize the parts that you look at and not the parts that you don't, and then farm out the different parts at different levels of compression. I mean, that sounds pretty clever. It doesn't just sound like a buzzword. You know, it is also a buzzword. That probably helps. But I like that. I mean, right? This is the part, these chatbots, we overtalk about chatbots and the chatbots that hallucinate. Now they just, I was reading Ben Thompson's story about how they wired it up, the chatbots up to like Wikipedia and Wolfram Alpha, and suddenly they can look at the internet to find answers. Guess what? The chatbots don't hallucinate so much now. It's amazing. But in this case, you know, before and after, before is, well, we just write an algorithm that very cleverly compresses video. After is, we can actually have a system identify the contents of every frame, prioritize what we, you know, do heavy compression on and what we do lighter compression on, and then and use that. And like, that's better, presumably, in the long run, but it's not something a human could ever do, because that would be a terrible job, to look at every frame and prioritize it. Although, I don't know, Alex may have people who do that.
Content-aware compression. It makes sense. Makes a lot of sense.
It's cool.
Yeah, no, it does make sense, because right now it's really brightness and contrast and stuff like that. It's like, oh, it's not looking for a face. It's looking for something that's brighter, and it's in the background, and so dark areas get beat up a little bit and light area. But absolutely, if you can say, I'm going to follow all the people and make sure that they're all sharp, and I'm going to let everything else, and you can get smart about how you do it, so it's blurred out rather than just chunky. And so there's a lot of things that it could do that are pretty interesting. And it really makes a difference for VR. So because we're sending so much data. So it's one thing to get your 1080p stream on YouTube to your phone. It's another thing to send you two 6K or 8K 120 frame per second streams to your headset is enormously bandwidth intensive. It'll, you know, so that's the other piece of that, is getting smart about that is a big deal.
Yeah. A lot of what's kind of interesting about it is, and I'm sure you have more direct experience with this than I do, Alex, but the idea of, okay, well, what if it's not quite so much of a bottleneck, because we can just as effectively upscale something that is within the bandwidth limits to using AI to a convincing degree on the device. Maybe we can up the frame rates in certain situations so that we don't necessarily have to send 120 frame per second video at 8K. Yeah. We can actually send 4K 60 or even HD 60.
When you look at the machine learning stuff that they're putting on the chips, 100%. Like, you could definitely be rebuilding some of those things based on, depending on what they put in the headset or what they put on the computers or however they do it. You know, that you're right that there's a lot of processing that can be built into the hardware to solve some of those issues.
I wonder about the
I have an NVIDIA right. streaming box that does exactly that, and it's so hard to tell on my 4K 4K mm-hmm. TV. I have to lift up the remote to find out whether I'm looking at actual 4K content or whether it's streaming HD content and simply upscaling it without my knowing it.
I'm thinking about the Apple Silicon story here too, and I know that seems a little bit weird, but you know, what's the one place? I mean, there's compressing video after the fact, but there's also capturing video on an iPhone. And, you know, the iPhone DSP, iPhone is already doing analysis of those images and frames as they come in and using them for all sorts of things. This is a face, right? This is shrubbery. Nobody, who will speak for the shrubbery? Maybe a topiary is what you're really into. But so you could also, I could see them, if this is an algorithm that prioritizes when it's encoding the video, you also have that possibility that when you're capturing high-resolution video on an iPhone, it's able to take that analysis that's being done and then apply it to the video that's written to disk so that it's much, right? So it's throwing away, more advanced way of throwing away the shrubbery before it gets onto the disk.
But it can also be all that stuff that the iPhone is doing is making it really good at making that ID. And then the headset just takes all the smarts that they figured out with the iPhone and just applies it to every video coming in. You know, sure. Just like as it comes in, it has so much experience doing that now and they've built it up. It can just process the video as it comes through. Yeah.
I don't know if you've been noticing, every time I go to Apple TV, it seems like they're going to launch another new show. The story is they plan to spend $1 billion on movies,
not TV. I think this is just movies, right?
Yeah, this is just acquiring movies from Sundance and other movies
and doing them on theatrical, right? Which is the big thing, is that they're going, part of the strategy. It's funny how things have changed since a couple of years ago. Now everybody sort of thinks, hey, you can make money at theatrical in movie theaters and still make money on your streaming service. Maybe you should do both.
Do both.
What an idea. Yep. And so that seems to be, although I love this, there are some one-offs that they're doing. Like they sealed the deal with Martin Scorsese by saying, yeah, Marty, we'll get you in a theater. We promise. But like in the long run, they need to find a partner who's a distributor who will find places for their movies in movie theaters. Yeah, they don't want to do that themselves. You really need to find a partner, one of these big distributors who's a big studio. And the reports this week are hilarious because they're very much like, Apple does not speak the same language as movie distributors do. And so all the distributors are like perplexed. They want to cut a deal with Apple. Apple seems to want to cut a deal with them. And yet it's a little like when we were talking about the NFL negotiating with Apple, where it's like, they just don't speak the same language. And I can't wait to see what happens, but I love the idea that somebody new encounters Apple as a company in their corporate culture and goes, whoa, these guys are really different. It's like, yeah, they are.
A billion is about what Amazon Prime is spending. Although if you think about it, that's not that many movies. They spent $200 million for the new Scorsese film with Leonardo DiCaprio, Killers of the Flower Moon. Maybe they get five movies, but that's
four Scorseses.
Yeah. The film will premiere at Cannes in May, a cinema release for a few months, then Apple TV. Plus other possible candidates, according to 9 to 5 Mac, include the spy thriller Argyle and Ridley Scott's Napoleon. So if you want to go to Waterloo with your VR headset. Yeah.
Ridley Scott is also one of those deals where they're like, yeah, Ridley, we'll get you a theatrical. But it sounds like their long-term strategy is that they're going to keep doing this, right?
They want to be a film studio, basically.
Netflix seems to be the only streamer that is committed to never showing a movie in a theater unless they have to qualify for an Oscar, that they just want to put it on Netflix. Everybody else is having that moment where they realize, and part of it is the marketing. Marketing a movie that's going into theaters is very economical. It's expensive, but what it does is it really increases perception and awareness of your movie. So you do a big marketing blitz, you put it in theaters, you make some money. It's profitable in theaters, probably.
Do people still go to movies in the theaters? I haven't been to a movie in a theater in 3 years, 4 years.
They do, and the numbers are coming back. But on top of it, all those ads you've run for it in the theater create that awareness. So when it drops on your streaming service, people have heard of it.
You gotta market.
Like the example I always want to give is that Apple had somebody nominated for an Oscar for a movie on Apple TV Plus, and I write about Apple for a living, and I had literally never heard of that movie. And it was on Apple TV Plus for months and got an Oscar nomination, and I'd never heard of it.
Yeah.
And that's the solution, at least in part, is you put them in theaters, you market them when they're in theaters, and then when they come on streaming, everybody goes, oh yeah, that movie, and then they might actually watch it, which is better.
The story originally came from Bloomberg, but not from Mark Gurman, Thomas Buckley, and Lucas Shaw. It's an ambitious effort, they say, to raise Apple's profile in Hollywood and lure subscribers to the streaming service. And yeah, it's all about theatrical. Do you think it's the people like Scorsese, out of vanity or tradition, want to be in theaters, and that makes that deal easier?
And there's rumors that Amazon's looking at AMC.
AMC is offered a quite a discount these days.
I think that there is this idea of being part of the zeitgeist of people going to theaters. I don't know if the theaters are necessarily by themselves. There's a in their current structure, it's unclear. Amazon's got some great theaters in LA, so they put up they have ones with LED.
Oh, that's interesting.
That would be an opportunity for
Apple to create a technologically advanced movie theater.
Yeah, I mean, and that's what I mean. Amazon's pushing the envelope.
The problem is, you need
right
thousands,
now.
And Apple's talking thousands of theaters.
You don't need thousands. Apple could. I mean, they're talking about. I mean, they're talking about theaters. I don't know if Apple's.
Well,
talking
when
about
high frame rate movies, when Ang Lee released Billy Lee's long halftime walk, there were two theaters in the U.S. that could show it at high frame rate. Two, but they were in New York and L.A. So. I guess
okay. I mean, the other one that was the one with Bruce Willis and not Bruce Willis. It was the
it was
high frame rate, 120 frames per second. Yeah. And the problem they get into is that there's some problems with high frame rate and action films.
You can't watch it in a theater. You can't watch it at home. You have to have a special place to see it.
Well,
headset.
I mean, headset.
Oh yeah, my VR helmet would do it.
I mean, you could see anybody who went to IMAX or whatever or Dolby to see the 48 frame version, where you see 48 frames underwater and then you see 24 above. Suddenly they were like, what happened? Why was the film all broken when they were above water? I was like, because it's always been that way.
That's
like, it's
film,
always,
baby.
It's just that you never got to see both of them next to each other before. Right. And so suddenly 48 looked amazing. And so, but 48 works well. Going much over that, when you get up into about 95 frames a second, it gets to be, you start getting people, a higher number of people start getting seasick because their brain is not able to process it as a video. But I think that Apple, to go back to what Apple's doing here, you don't need that many theaters. You're doing it to get, going back out to theaters. You don't have to do a major release. This is kind of,
they're saying 1,000 theaters.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think part of it is that, remember that you're talking about Brad Pitt, you're talking about Martin Scorsese and Leonardo DiCaprio. These people are used to getting financial deals where they get dollar for dollar or based on box office receipts.
Good point.
It's kind of hard. And their account, and also equally their accountants understand how movie studio accountants are going to try to screw their clients over in a theatrical release. They don't yet understand how they get screwed over via a direct-to-video release. So I think that even if it's just 1,000 screens in the U.S. plus the international release, that's enough to get Leonardo DiCaprio that $50 million payday by the time the day is done.
Yeah, remember that was a big controversy about getting paid. That's right. Yeah.
Well, to your point, though, I think that they would rather buy an entire theater chain and give people their percentage of the box office than give them the stats on their playouts.
Right, on the streams. They tell nobody. I remember Ben Stiller said that I never knew how many people watched Severance. We couldn't get that information out of them.
Remember Scarlett Johansson sued Disney because her payout was based on the idea of having a huge tentpole release Marvel movie, and they said, we'll just toss it on Disney Plus, and thank you for the subscribers, Scarlett. I'm like, no, get out the checkbook.
She won, I think. Lucas and Buckley, I'm sorry, Lucas Shaw and Thomas Buckley, writing in Bloomberg, say that while Apple still hasn't figured out how it will distribute these movies in theaters. The company doesn't have the expertise internally to release movies in thousands of cinemas worldwide at once, which is why it's approached third-party distributors. The Scorsese movie is owned by Paramount, Paramount will release it in theaters, and they will get a 10% distribution fee, but it's not clear what Apple plans with future titles. Coda, which Apple won an Oscar as Best Picture for in 2021, they paid $25 million for it at Sundance. They earned less than $2 million at the box office. Of course, that was in the height of COVID. So, I mean, this is complicated, and movies are you know, kind of up in the air right now anyway because of COVID. And so it'll be interesting to see. Nevertheless, I have to say Apple's releasing so many new, I don't know if you've noticed this on Apple TV, but there's a lot of Apple originals, and this is still the bulk of their investment in TV, coming.
I'm actually Tetris pretty excited about Tetris.
Pretty amazing.
Yeah. Tetris looks great. That comes out Friday with Taron Egerton. It's the story of, and I interviewed him when the original author, Alexei Pajitnov, who wrote it in the Soviet Union, I interviewed him because eventually came to the U.S. And I said, how much did you get paid for releasing Tetris to the world? He said, they gave me a new PC. That's all he got is a high-end personal computer, which at that time was probably a 286.
80 column card, upper and lower case.
Unbelievable. He was so good.
CGA graphics.
I doubt Alexei Pajitnov made the billions of dollars he deserves for one of the most successful games of all time. But yeah, I can't wait to watch that movie. There's a new Jennifer Garner movie. There's Ghosted. There's the Big Door Prize. Silo Schmigadoon is coming back. Prehistoric Planet is coming back. There's Hijack.
Silo is based on Wool by Hugh Howey, which was a real cult hit. It was originally self-published on Amazon, became a hit. Eventually, he got a publishing deal, and now he's got a TV show. So,
they're doing another season of the show nobody watched, Foundation. Watched that?
Dirty Little Secret about Apple. I thought it was okay, not great, but okay. But the dirty little secret about a lot of these Apple projects and a lot of streaming projects is there's a wink, wink, nudge, nudge order that is not 1 year. They announce a year because that allows them to then announce a renewal. Right. But I get the strong impression that Foundation was probably going to they had a 2 year contract for that. If they didn't announce it, they might have even announced it initially. But there are a lot of those that happen. Yeah, that happens a lot now where there's the secret, they're already doing it. A lot of times these renewal announcements are, they're just PR. Like, the contract's already signed, it's just PR.
That Dune, which was only half the novel, didn't have a green light for part two.
Yeah, until it became a huge hit, and then they rushed it into production, I guess, and we're going to finally see it later this year,
Just killed me.
Yeah.
Anyway, yeah. Apple, I mocked Apple TV Plus for a long time, but now it's really, especially if you buy Apple One, which probably a lot of people do, it's a no-brainer. You got the Apple Music, you get the Apple TV Plus, you get all the stuff. Yeah.
Shrinking is one of my favorite things I've seen.
You know, I've heard
TV
great things, and I'm glad we kind of waited till the season that's now all out. We finally forced ourselves to watch the rest of Servant, which is a good but weird show. And I can't wait to see Severance coming back. That'll be huge. And of course, Ted Lasso. Has the third season been good? Is it?
It is good. It's just getting started, though, right? Like they have their themes, and they're going to make you watch all 12 episodes to get the themes. We haven't mentioned baseball, but it is baseball week, and so baseball is starting, and it's starting on Apple TV Plus too. And the big news.
Woohoo!
This time is one, they're not going to give it away for free anymore. You got to be a TV Plus subscriber. Last year they gave it away for free.
Yeah.
But two, biggest complaint, and we talked about it here, biggest complaint everybody had.
Yes.
They're fans of their local radio announcers, their local TV announcers. They don't want to hear the national announcer that Apple is supplying. So they announced late last week, they announced, yes, you can turn it to your local broadcaster's audio while you're watching.
Huge.
So you can tune out their national MLB network announcers and just put on your local radio. Unless you're a fan of the Texas Rangers, this is only in the U.S. where if you're a fan of the Texas Rangers and they're on the road, you can't hear your radio guys. I don't know why. It's a mystery. But otherwise, and then in Canada, they're doing something a little bit different where the Blue Jays radio will be on, but only the Blue Jays radio in Canada will be an option. But still, they totally heard people's complaints about their beloved home team announcers, and they did what they should do because it's a pure digital product, is add some audio overlays. So there'll be multiple audio overlays for those baseball games.
That's not super hard.
It's contractually hard. That's what's hard.
That's what we saw. But I mean, from a technical, it's like send us a fee. We put in another stream in the HLS. Add it to the manifest.
I'd say the only thing that's technically hard about it is that you've got to make sure that in your pipeline you're getting the audio and the video to be roughly the same time. You need to probably have it happen at the ballpark. Because you know if they're like 8 seconds out of sync, it's a disaster. But we'll see how they do.
The crack of the bat has to be audible at the same time as it actually hits the ball, or it's really disconcerting. You know, you don't want to see the guy go and then hear. It's no good.
You know, some Alex probably knows about this, but some TV broadcasts of sports cheat. They actually put the announcer audio slightly ahead of the video. There's a delay in that, and that allows them to seem like they're calling it as it happens, even though and the giveaway is baseball, which is sometimes you can hear the crack of the bat on the announcer mic before you hear it or see it.
Yeah, and usually when they're wearing the headsets or using the really directional mics, you won't hear any of that. And it's usually pretty careful about it because usually your FX mics are on the field. They're getting the best sound. I mean, on just a simple basketball game, it's like 27 mics.
It's different for baseball because it's old fashioned. The radio guys drop them. I know this because I used to work at KMBR. They drop a microphone out the booth and it just sits there swinging. And of course the fans immediately discover it and start yelling, "You're a jerk."
Yep. Classic.
I don't like you, Hank Greenwald.
There was a game when I was in high school that I was listening to. It was Ron Fairley was the announcer for the Giants
that year.
Oh, I hated
Ron Fairley.
And he was terrible. He made three mistakes in the course of one at bat. And it was Candlestick Park, so there was nobody there. And then there was silence, and then you heard from below, "You're making a fool of yourself, Fairley."
I used to listen just for that.
Amazing.
Oh.
And I think that people would complain less about it if the national announcer was good. I think
that's right. The baseball announcers were terrible on Apple.
But it was terrible. But I will say, to be fair, announcing sports is really hard.
It's highly skilled.
Like it is. Yeah. It is such a skill. And there's, even in football, like you watch national football and there's all these games and they have to cover, 13, 14 games at a time and everything else. And those guys spend the entire week absorbing all of the information that they have to be available for. And then a lot of it's just based on their experience. And even then, there's like four that are good. out of all of those announcers, maybe six. And then it falls off. And they're doing the best they can to try to fill that in, And so I think that it is what Apple, I complained about it a lot. But I will say that for announcing it's so much stuff in real time that's coming into you that you have. And baseball is a little easier because it's not quite as fast. But there's still so much in real time that's coming in that you have to, you just have to know it all. And it's really, really hard to find those people. And I think Apple missed it, but it's not like they missed a slow ball. They missed a fastball that is just hard to hit.
I think you're harder on the announcers than I am. There are very few national announcers who I would consider good. Like even the ESPN, ESPN Sunday night, broadcast is not very good. They're most of the good announcers are announcing for local teams, which is as it should be. But they're super. Even if I give it to you, I mean, like they're super generic. And if you're watching a team you don't care about, then I think you don't care. But if it's a team you care about, you want to hear your people who understand your team and depending on where you live, they're either rooting for your team or at least they understand that you're rooting for your team. Yeah. And I'm glad Apple. I think the miracle here is that Apple and MLB worked on this and made the contractual whatever they needed to do to get those radio broadcasts available on the Friday night broadcast, because they had to do something different in terms of rights. That's why it's only in the U.S. and the one team in Canada and not the rest of the places that Apple TV is showing these games. So I'm glad they did it. Like they made the effort and that's to make their product better.
100%.
And that's a good sign. Yep.
I really wish Apple could do something like Twitch for sports where yes, have those professional announcers that are basically tied to the broadcast, but also create a mechanism so that if I deem myself an expert on the Red Sox and I want to take it upon myself to do a simulcast so that I can basically put my mug or my living room with four other friends like in a sub window and do my own call of the game, be it a serious call, be it mocking everything that's going on, or be it, no, I want to basically be the local sports announcer for Boston that has that entire Boston perspective with the history, the past, present, and the future, and basically somehow find a way to monetize that. That is something that I would be that would make me into a more avid follower of sports, because oftentimes it really isn't I would love to watch the NFL some more. I would love to watch the NBA some more, but a lot of the announcers, they really are way more intense than I can really follow. And if I found someone who was sort of like the simpleton, the knowledgeable expert who speaks down to simpletons like me, I would be watching more NBA games. And if I could give this person $5 a month so I could follow this game, I might even spend that $5 a month.
Amazon has experimented with that. Amazon has been doing this thing on their Thursday night football broadcast where they've got a couple different play-by-play groups, and then they've got like the alt play-by-play audio where like they had like an improv troupe do it one time, and like I love those experiments. And it's like ESPN has the Manning cast where Peyton and Eli Manning make fun of each other, and more of that, please. It's great.
The thing is, yeah, to go the exact opposite way, the Manning broadcast is the potential of something explosive, which is that you have two, you know, grade, you know, level A quarterbacks that know each other really well. And when they drop into geek mode and they start just talking, like watching the game and talking when they bring in somebody else and they're telling jokes, it's super boring. Like I just leave it. And I think ESPN is, you know, their producers are trying to make it a show, you know, but what really makes it great is these two top quarterbacks sitting there just talking. You see what he's doing there. He's going to do a curl there, and he's going to do this, and he's going to, and this is what he did there. And this is how look at how he's going through his progressions. He's going boom, boom, boom. He missed this one. And they start to just, the two of them will riff for like 10 or 15 minutes. And it's just gold, because now you're really in it. Like you're in the room where it happens kind of thing, where suddenly all those things are there. And I think that's what, you know, and again, some people want that. Some people want, hey, they're about to do a run play, or they just did a run play. A run play is this, and da da da. And you want that basic version of it. Like, I don't understand what this is. You know, for me, I don't understand. We had to stream like 27 basketball games, and we had all these different commentaries. And by the end, I understood how basketball worked. So, but until before that, I was like, it's just random. People are running back and forth. But we had an ex-player from one of the teams and a social media guy talking about the you know, going back and forth and answering people's questions live that they were posting while watching the game. And it was super fascinating.
Yeah.
And it was way better than any coverage of those games, because we could see the other coverage. And I was like, I'd much rather watch this. He's like, oh, look at what they're doing there. They shouldn't have gone down that path. And they're just kind of like, they're not trying to impress anybody. They're just talking the way that they would talk if they were watching the game. And I think that would be great, to Andy's point, as many options as possible. You know, like that we could have to look at those.
Gentlemen, get your picks ready. We are going to take a little break, come back with picks of the week. But first, a little plea. First, before I get into the plea, a thank you to our club members who are paying for this episode of Mac Break Weekly. You might have noticed a dearth of advertisers. If you are not yet a Club Twit member and you want to keep this show and all the shows we do on the air, you want to keep the lights on, the staff well employed, you want to develop new shows, may I make a gentle request? Join Club Twit. It's only $7 a month, $84 a year. There's a corporate membership plan as well. What do you get? Ad-free versions of all of our shows. You get access to the great Club Twit Discord, where fun and mirth and merriment are always happening. Also, great discussions, not just about the shows, but about every geeky topic possible. We also do a lot of stuff in the club, in the Discord. Stacy's Book Club is coming up April 6th. We do Home Theater Geeks now, which was something we relaunched. We had to shut down a couple of years ago with Scott Wilkinson because of lack of ad support and lack of audience support. But thanks to the club, we're able to bring it back. It's a club only right now, but if it grows in time, as This Week in Space did, it might be emerging into the public. We have interviews with staff, like the Inside Twit Chat later this month, or later in April, with Victor Bognot, Alex Wilhelm, Sean Powers from Floss Weekly. Our community manager, Aunt Pruitt, is fantastic, has put together a wonderful series of events. It is a great place to hang. The Twit Plus feed, not just new shows you don't hear anywhere else, like Hands on Macintosh with Micah Sargent, but also bits that appear before and after the shows, stuff from the cutting room floor. I think we've really tried to give you a lot of value for your $7. So if you would like to support what we do, please go to twit.tv/clubtwit and sign up today. We appreciate it. $7 a month. And thank you, members of Club Twit, for making this all possible. Now, time for our picks of the week. Jason Snell, let's kick it off with you.
Back in January, I talked about a great tool from OpenAI, not the one you're thinking of. It's called Whisper, and it is an amazing thing that takes audio and turns it into a text transcript at a quality that is better than anything I've ever seen. And at the time, it was very much like, well, you can download this thing and compile it and then figure that out. And maybe eventually you'll get to a way where you can run it. Well, guess what? A very good Mac developer named Jordy Bruin created this app called Whisper Transcription. It's in the Mac App Store. It's free. If you want to use the high quality models, there's a single in-app purchase that you can make. And what he's done is it's a capable Mac developer taking the inscrutable command line command chicanery of Whisper and building an entire GUI wrapper around it. And not only did he do the basics, like I wrote a shortcut that did that, right? Like you could do that part of it. But what this app has done is he's now trying to figure out other Mac-like app things he can layer on top of it. You can watch as the transcript's going. You can choose after the fact what formats you want to save it as. You can choose from any of the models. I have a long-term question about, like, where is Whisper going? And is it going to continue to be updated? And is Jordy Bruin going to, you know, use a different, if there's a different project that I think he's using the C model that I'm also using that's like the fastest right now. But if there's one for Neural Engine, does that get dropped in instead? Like there's a lot of questions about it. But the beauty of this is now if you don't want to go into the command line or anything like that, but you are curious about having the ability to drag audio, like one of the most popular podcast formats around is church podcasts, right? It's like, so if you're the guy, AV guy who does your church podcast and you want to do a text of a thing that somebody came up and said that was extemporaneous and there's no script, you drag and drop, watch it go by, select the text, and you've got it. And you might not be the kind of person who's going to go compile that C++ code. So I think this is a great example. Back in the early days of Mac OS X, we saw this a lot where people were writing GUI wrappers around command line stuff to make it feel like a Mac app. And I haven't seen a lot of those lately, but this is a good example of that. So I think this is a nice... like for regular people on the Mac to use Whisper, which is it's like a magic trick. I mean, it's worth trying out the free version just to drag some audio on it and be amazed at how good it is at its job.
It really points towards an amazing future about how we share content and how we understand what's going on around us. Where, you know, we were talking about the fact that you're going to get to a point where you, in office hours, we're talking about that you're going to get to a point where there's a council meeting. It's going to translate it into 60 languages. It's going to summarize it in those languages. It's going to put them all into audio with different voices, and it's going to put them all out. And it's all going to happen in like a half an hour after the thing happened, and everyone can have it. And being able to have that content just rolling out of there automatically. And this is one connection to that, but there's just so many places where you want to do this. And it's always been, I've done so much transcription and so much captioning and so on and so forth. I totally agree with you. It's just an amazing, amazing app. It is a must download. It's free, must download if you want to get it's really cool.
And I presume if you were listening to a podcast like this one that doesn't have a transcript, you could do it yourself, right? How fast is it? Is it real time?
It depends on how fast your computer is. On my Mac Studio, it is like two or three times real time. But on a like a MacBook Air, it might be real time ish. And the big thing that it doesn't do, and I know I mentioned this in January, is the Whisper AI model right now doesn't do speaker detection, and that is a next for a podcast. You really want to be able to say this speaker is, even if it's just speaker one, speaker two. And right now it doesn't do that. Because it's an AI model, sometimes it'll put like a little line at the beginning that indicates it's a new speaker. Sometimes it doesn't. I've also had it hallucinate speaker names. I did one thing where I did a transcript between me and John Siracusa, and it called us like John and Dave. I don't know who Dave is. It decided I was
that
Dave.
That would be
I'm
easy. Actually, that's good if it assigns some name, because you could then go do a mass replace, right? Dave is now Jason.
Right, and if it inferred from the text our names, that would be really cool, too. And that's all coming, right? Like Alex said, like I want to say next year, but I feel like with AI, it's probably next month.
Yeah,
it'll all be better, and they'll do all of that, too.
So this is free, small fee if you want to use more advanced features, whisper transcription from Good Snooze. Alex, your pick of the week, Alex.
I got a new camera.
And of course
so
you
people
did.
People already pinged me about it.
Of course you
already
did.
Thinking about it while I'm on the show. So I was like, well, I'll make that the pick. So I Sony sent me the FR7, and it was too expensive. I can't afford that. So, but what I got hooked on was the fact that I could have the autofocus would work really, really well, and I could rock in and out, and I could do all those things. So I couldn't afford the FR7. They sent me the FR7. I had it for a couple of weeks, and it just ruined me. Like it was the color rendition and the sharpness and everything else. So people have been already pinging me on it while I've been on the show, and I'm using an FX30. This is the less expensive version. So it's still a little pricey, but this is an FX30 with I did get it all a 1.4 FE lens. So 35mm. So that's
I have a bunch of Sony GM lenses. Yep. Could I use those? Yeah.
Yep. Yeah. It's just a Sony mount. GM yep. mount. I will say that what happened was, the Sony one was there, and John Wallace, who's in Office Hours, bought a couple of these for his web, for his stuff. Same thing I'm doing here. And I'm, I do this almost professionally. I mean, I do it here professionally, but I'm on air, 2 or 3 hours a day. So it's worth the investment to.
Are you using it right now? Is that what we're looking at right now?
Yeah, this is what I'm using right now.
I noticed immediately it looked really good. Yeah. It's picking up all the gray in your eyebrows. It's fantastic. Yeah,
exactly. The big thing is that you can do this where it pulls into focus.
Oh my God, that was fast.
And then you just come right back out, and it just does the thing.
That's
that's
nice.
The thing that it's the best autofocus. The Sony has the best.
Sony's
autofocus.
Always had the best autofocus. Yeah,
but
it's an APS-C sensor. Is that a bad thing?
Super 35. Yeah, yeah. The full frame, the FX3, is another $2,000, and I chose not to go down that path.
If you're shooting 4K video, you wouldn't be using the full frame anyway, right? You can't. You don't need all.
Well,
the pixels.
I could. The full frame would be nice, but this if my background got any blurrier than it is already, it would be not.
I like the bokeh. It's beautiful.
Right. It's good. It's a good bokeh, but you want to see some of the stuff back there. You don't want it to be like a wash of color. Maybe some people do, but so I thought it was fine. I'm going to take this to NAB and use it as part of my coverage. We've got like a ton of NAB coverage. And so I'm going to test it. I'm probably going to get another lens that's a zoom lens that's a little less and take it there and put it in a cage and shoot a bunch of stuff with it.
How does this compare with their Alpha S's? Because the A7S is a.
Well, those are full frame.
They're full frame and they're video intended video.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't think that they have full frame HDMI. This has a full frame HDMI out.
Ah, okay.
It's nice. It's powered by USB-C, which is really nice.
Yeah.
As someone
so it's
has,
really specifically has, for cinema.
But
they say
camera.
That with the S as I well. I mean, this is confusing.
I mean, if I was doing quote unquote cinema, I'd still be going towards the FX3, FX6, FR7. This one is it's a cinema line. It is, and again, I haven't taken it anywhere handheld or taken it out.
Canon's done this too. They've really bifurcated their lines for cinema and stills.
And it's nice and small. It's light. It is, again, it's got a full sized HDMI. It's got USB-C. I got to tell you, like Blackmagic has a very specific plug for power. And there's a little PTSD that goes on with losing, not being able to find the power cable.
Yeah.
So being able to just grab anything that does USB-C and plug it into the side of the camera, it's really nice. And it's a great little camera. And again, if I was doing multi-camera like live, I'd still use Blackmagic because I can shade all the cameras separately and I can sync them all together. So it's not, I don't think it's a replacement for what I've been doing with Blackmagic cameras, but as a as what I'm using it for here, potentially some coverage that I'm doing, I'm going to probably keep on using that. And I think we are going to mix and match some Sony cameras at NAB with the live views that we're using there. So it should be good. But yeah, the full frame, when you go up a little bit more expensive, you're going to go full frame, and Sony's probably going to do a lot more full frame, which is going to be nice. But Sony's really, I think, hitting on all cylinders.
They really are.
To the cameras. Yeah.
This sounds like the kind of thing my son should be using for his Reels and his TikToks and his YouTubes.
You know, it's funny. I was talking to a YouTuber and I asked her, like, why aren't you using a Blackmagic camera? And she was just immediately like, autofocus. like she was just like, it was an instant. It was just like, autofocus, you know, yeah. and it's good enough that it really, that's why I sat there in the store kind of moving it around, focusing on this and focusing on that and seeing how well it worked. And it's really snappy.
Yeah,
so, and that
great.
Makes a big difference when you're trying
that's,
to build that.
That's, I mean, it is a still camera too. The Alpha yep. Line, the A9 is amazing how fast it can focus and follow things and lock in on birds and stuff. The CinemaLine FX30 Super 35, it's mere $1,800, which actually you might say, well, that sounds like a lot of money. It's hardly anything. It's not even three Alexes.
It's cheap. I mean, a lot of the cameras price. That you buy in that realm is about that price.
It's all about the glass.
I wasn't willing.
The glass is expensive.
I spent almost as much on the glass as I spent on the camera.
And since I have all that great glass, I'm always looking for a body like that.
Well, this is a great one if you want to have something on the road to shoot with that is like your video camera. So that's good. And it's a full frame glass, so if I move up or do something else, I can do it. But I think it's good.
Very nice. And Inako, you got a pick for us?
Yeah, something really, really simple, but which solves a problem for me. I was looking for a really cheap but really useful flashlight as an everyday carry, and not in my pockets, but basically I want to have a flashlight that's in my laptop bag and in my small little bag and in my backpack and everything like that, so that, you know, you never know. And so when I'm taking my walks like late at night, I'm not going to trip and stumble and wind up in the mud. And I was looking for something really, really cheap, and I found something really cheap and cheerful, and I really like the design of it. Now this is if you do an Amazon or eBay search for what's called it's usually under what's called COB keychain light, COB, and you'll find them. It's hysterically funny. If you go on Amazon, you'll find some sellers will sell you one of these for $18. Some of them will sell you like three for $10. If you go directly to AliExpress, you can buy them literally for $1.
Wow.
But it's not a piece of junk. It has three different lighting modes, two different intensities of light. It also has a flasher mode, which is another reason why I need something like this. Like when it's late at night and I can tell that the Uber is kind of in the neighborhood, but doesn't know where to pick me up. As soon as I put on the flasher, it says, okay, maybe that's where I should go. But three different modes. It charges via USB-C, so I can use like my regular charging packs for it. The design is actually very nice. It has a carabiner clip, so I can clip it onto my backpack harness. It also has a magnet on the back, so I can just, when the lights go out inevitably on the MBTA on the commuter rail, I can just stick this up on the baggage compartment, and it will illuminate. It also has a little fold-out stand with two different annoyances on it, and the full charge lasts about 2 or 3 hours. On the low setting, the bright setting is kind of almost too bright for me. It's cheap enough that I didn't buy them on AliExpress. I bought one as cheap as I could get it on Amazon just to see if it would, you know, start a fire after I leave it charging overnight. And then after this one worked out for a couple of weeks, I bought like another four. For again about $3 each, and like I say, this is not—it's not the most sophisticated flashlight you can get. It's not it's not a Kickstarter where someone is promising to change the world and disrupt the mode of artificial LED illumination. It's just a super cheap Chinese flashlight that it's simple and small enough that you can have one exactly everywhere that you're going to need it without having to remember. Gee, did I remember to bring this with me or not? Did I take this out of a certain other thing or not? And yeah, it's certainly very very well. And this, it also, and of course, waste not, want not. On the, they decided that one of the sides of it, they decided to put a can opener to a bottle opener too.
Yay!
So yeah. You know what? You get a lot for your dollar to $3 here. So again, you'll find. Don't make sure if you buy it on Amazon. Again, make sure you do math in your head of how much they're charging, because you will find people who are charging truly $19 for one of these, and then you scroll like half a click and you'll find, oh, four for $10. Yeah, that was a bit. And it's the exact same thing.
John says that the COB is because the LEDs are arranged like a corn cob, but in fact he's hallucinating like an AI. That's not what COB stands for.
He was probably looking into the light and it's like, oh my god, it's so dazzling.
So, golly, there are a lot of them. I'm tempted to buy the one from a company whose name looks a lot like Abandoned Ship.
Abandoned Ship, I know. I got that, too.
Just because I like the name, the pseudo-English name that the Chinese company came up with. Yeah. Is that the one you bought, the Abandoned Ships?
No. I think the one I bought, it's almost immaterial which company I bought it from.
Yeah.
The first one I bought from was like $4. And then there's another one that gives you like 10 for 32 or something. I might have waited for AliExpress for literally $1 and wait a couple weeks to get it from China.
Yeah,
I mean, it's, and also at this price, you can have extras and just give them to people who need them when you encounter
Here's
them.
Here's one that says Score 8. Has 3 for $8.99. That sounds like the low price leader.
Yeah,
yeah. And they all do the same thing.
they all do the same thing. Almost certainly. And some of them are claiming, oh no, this is 1,000 lumens. No. This one is 800 lumens. Oh, this is only 500 lumens. There might be a couple of different varieties. I think when I was scrolling, I found one or two that were still charging with micro USB.
Oh, that's maybe. Not good. We don't want that.
But as far as I can tell, these are all like the exact same units. They're just maybe a different days of different on the assembly line.
Yeah. All right. I think I might order these because I was thinking I should have a flashlight or two in the backpack, but I don't want to carry a big old traditional flashlight. Yeah.
Again, this is tiny. This is like a morsel size. And also, once again, it's 2 hours off, 2 or 3 hours off its own battery, but it can also power directly off of my like 20,000 milliamp hour battery USB-C. And of course, I'm going to have a USB-C to USB-C cable somewhere. So.
I'll do my pick real quick. It just came out, infinitemac.org. It is actually the guy who does this. is a legend and has been doing all sorts of interesting things going back to Grease Monkey days. But he has created a web-based simulator for every version of Mac OS from System 1 to System 9.0.4. And you could just run it. It'll boop. It'll beep. It'll start up. And look how fast it is. I don't think that's this, is it? Is that coming from this? I wonder if I have something else open. No, that's it, huh? All right. This is an infinite Mac.
Yep. Yeah. And you see the entire startup process. You see the Happy Mac. You see all these system extensions load in. There's QuickTime.
Let's run disk first aid. Do the drive. Open. It's hysterical. Anyway, if you have some nostalgia for this, or you youngins, if you don't remember what it was like to have a desk accessory called Scrapbook, here's your chance to relive the history of the Mac. Infinite Macs, for you.
And incidentally, did you check the hard drive? Because here's Photoshop, here's Graphic Converter, here's KidPix, Kai's Power Tips.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah.
So thanks to Mihai.
Photoshop 3.05.
Parparita. Mihai has done Tailscale, Quip, Chrome Apps, Google Reader, Iconographer, Overplot, Gmail, Grease Monkey Scripts, and a whole bunch more. He's been around for some time. And he said, I wanted to get this out in March. So it's out now. The Infinite Mac at infinitemac.org. Just fun to play with. You can do, there's similar things at archive.org. But these are really well done. They're really fast.
There is no difference. I'm running 9.02 right now, and there's no stutter. There's no lag. Opening, it is like, I'm sure it's 10 times faster than any actual 9.02.
Well, that's
Mac
the irony,
that I might
right?
have ever owned. Yeah.
Yeah, this is running in the browser, and it's lots faster.
Yeah.
Look at this. Here's System 7. So you say, look into productivity. Oh, there's ClarisWorks. Mm-hmm. Wow. And there's the music. I don't know what the deal is with the music. Look at that. ClarisWorks 5.
I'm not getting
five.
The music. So.
I don't get where the music... Maybe it's coming from somewhere else.
I think it's coming from somewhere else. I'm not getting it.
Let's not register ClarisWorks right now. Let's do some word prompt. Look at that.
Yeah.
That's amazing. Some memories. Memories from the good old days. Look at that. Wow. This is the color one, System 7. All right. Thank you, everybody. That concludes this thrilling, gripping edition of Mac Break Weekly. We managed to eke out a pretty nice, long show. Thank you, Jason Snell. You're going to take over for me next week with Dan Morin and the regulars, Alex and Andy. I thank you for doing that, Jason.
Yes. Looking forward to it.
Sixcolors.com/Jason to find all of the things that he does.
All of the many things.
Yeah. He is a legend in the industry. And I'll be following you on my encrypted wavelength app as I travel around.
For many years now, they've been telling the legend about the guy who writes about computers.
It's the legend.
Some say he doesn't exist. Others say he's just a guy who works in his garage.
Just don't ask him about his big blue ox. Thank you, Jason. I appreciate you filling in.
Thanks, Leo. Have a good vacation.
I will, I promise. Also, Andy Inaka, when are you going to be on GBH next?
Actually, I don't have my schedule for April yet. I'm off this week. But go to WGBHnews.org to listen to previous shows. You can also go to the WGBH News channel on YouTube to see the ones that the tech news stuff that I did when on either Tuesdays or Fridays when we were at the Boston Public Library. I was actually in the Boston Public Library on last Friday, had a really great chat about ChatGPT and Bard and stuff like that, the sort of thing where I had a docket of four different topics, and some of them were very, very technical, and we never got past the fourth one because it was such a good the first one because it was such a good conversation.
We have learned the music you were hearing is the on hold music from the Discord stage. I thought I had muted my Discord stage, but apparently I have not. So apologies.
It sounds like, you know what threw me? It sounds like perfect, like technical difficulties, please stand by music.
It's totally. It's even got a little, you know, Hammond organ in there. It was quite, I was impressed. But I apologize. That is not part of Infinite Mac, as much as you might wish it. OfficeHours.global is where you will find Mr. Alex Lindsay pretty much anytime. The Fundamentals of Green Screen Today featuring AI-generated Muppets.
I did. It was great. You know, the problem that I have is that I don't shoot very much bad green screen. Like, I just, because I'm so particular, because that's going to cost money. And when I was looking for samples, I was like, I can't find clean or beat up green screen. I was like, I bet you I can get it. Mid-Journey to generate this for me. And so I just threw it in a Mid-Journey, and I was like, Muppets will be funny. And it turned out really well. Got wrinkles. I have folds. I have gradients. I have all the things you shouldn't do with your green screen. So it was a lot of fun.
It's free. It's open to all. And you can even join the Zoom if you have questions. Details at officehours.global. And if you want to hire Alex, as many do, to run your next live streaming event or just to consult, he is at 090.media. 090.media. Oh, the $1,000 studio on Friday.
Yeah, we're going to kind of go up. So we're going to start at $1,000. Then there's a $10,000 studio, $25,000. Like, you know, like, what would you do if you had more money? Like, what would you add to it? So we're starting at $1,000 and we'll go up over the next couple months, you know, 1 month at a time, just to talk about what equipment is. What would you add when that's possible?
That's
because
cool.
A lot of people building studios right now. So we're talking about it because a lot of companies are looking at building their own.
Awesome. Thank you, Alex. Thank you, Andy. Thank you, Jason. Be back next week, Jason, with Dan Morin, Alex Lindsay, Andy Inaka. Mike Sargent is going to host the show the weeks following. I will be back About a month from, believe it or not, about a month from now, my next show will be on April 25th. And I will be...
Long-delayed vacation.
Yeah. Glad yeah, this is actually a vacation we booked in 2019 that was canceled twice, I believe, during COVID. And finally, we're going to get to go to a different place, but that's okay. Everybody, I appreciate your being here. We do Mac Break Weekly on Tuesdays, 11 a.m. Pacific, 2 p.m. Eastern, 1800 UTC. The live stream, audio or video at live.twit.tv. Watching live, chat live with us, irc.twit.tv. If you're a club member, of course, the Discord is also a great place to hang. After the fact, on-demand versions of the show are available, ad-supported, or in this case, not, at twit.tv/mbw. You can also get a YouTube. There's a YouTube channel dedicated to it. Actually, the easiest thing to do is go to youtube.com/twit. All of the shows that have dedicated YouTube channels are listed there. So you can subscribe to the ones you want to follow. Probably the easiest subscription, though, is to do it in a podcast player. That way you'll get it. It'll download. You can get audio or video, your choice. It'll download and you'll have it for your listening or viewing pleasure anytime as fits your needs. Thanks for being here. But now I have to say, I'm sorry, get back to work because break time is over. And one third of you should be getting back to the office.
Do you want to hear about the latest news happening in the tech world from the people who write the article? Sometimes from the people who are actually making the news? Well, we got a show for you here at twit.tv. It's called Tech News Weekly. Me, Jason Howell, and my co-host Micah Sargent, we talk with some amazing people each and every Thursday on Tech News Weekly, and we share a little bit of our own insights in each of us bringing a story of the week. That's at twit.tv/TNW. Subscribe right now.